It's time for Twig. We got a great show for you. Stacey Higginbotham is here from Austin. Jeff Jarvis from New Jersey. And all the way from Yorkshire in the UK, Kevin Marks is going to dial in. We'll talk about the latest news from Google. We got a couple of interesting talks at the Code Conference. We'll debate the meaning of Covfefe. And then we'll look at Mary Meeker's slide presentation on the future of the Internet. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 407. Recorded Wednesday, May 31st, 2017. Grepping Mary Meeker. This Week in Google is brought to you by NatureBox. Delicious snacks made from high-quality ingredients. Eat well and feel better. Visit naturebox.com/twit to save 50% off your first order. And by Upside, the smart new way to save big money on business travel. Visit upside.com and enter the code TWIG to be guaranteed at least a $100 gift card when you book your first trip. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twig. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news from the Googleverse. Stacey Higginbotham is here from the IoT podcast, Stacey on IoT.com. And, You wore a dress to match your hair. I think that's lovely. And a necklace, too.
I'm coordinated today.
You really are. Am I blue?
Let's see. Oh, can you see them?
And yes. And blue bracelets. Very cute.
Shoes? Celebrating shoes? Spring. What are the shoes?
It is. She looks like a robin.
The shoes are silver, but I'm not wearing them.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That's Jeff Jarvis, who's also a little dressed up from his appearance on MSNBC this morning. How nice.
Talking Covfefe.
That's Kevin Marks.
No, I say Covfefe. Hillary Clinton just said Covfefe.
Oh, wow. Everybody's talking
there
about
it. There could be Covfefe. I'm not sure. What's our vote here?
It's spelled K-O-V-F-E. K-O-V-F-E.
And I can't think of anyone better to ask who's a classically trained, smart person than the next person you're going to introduce.
Mr. Kevin Marks.
Hello there.
From Yorkshire.
North Yorkshire.
North Yorkshire. That's really north. Excuse me.
Well, I went to the coffee shop in Stokesley today. I just put the picture in the chat. And
British
I went
you.
To the bathroom, and on the wall was this part of the wallpaper was this image. So I think it's actually Co versus Fifi. if you look at the link I just put in, you'll see what I mean.
I'm looking for the link. I'm not sure where you put it, but I'm looking.
Oh, I put it in the chat room. Sorry.
In the chat room. Wow, you're the most sophisticated guest we
he
have.
He is. Every time he's on here, I'm like, oh, Kevin Marks, you're so good.
So this is
the
from a coffee shop.
The coffee shop, and I went to the bathroom and was like, wait, what? So I think this is the hidden message, or else I should check the rest of the wallpaper there and see what
you should have added some smart graffiti.
So around about 1 a.m. Washington time, the president tweeted. The tweet's gone. It's been removed. What did he say? Jeff, read it to us.
Yeah,
I don't have it handy.
Okay.
It was in the New York Times. Did a story on it. I was up
here
at 3
is.
This
I've got
morning.
It. I've yeah, got it. Find it. Despite the constant negative, it's actually quite beautifully crafted. Despite the constant negative press, Covfefe. And then somebody named Covfefe the Strong says, I have been summoned. And then the wizard Covfefe says, no, you fool, it is I who have been summoned by the great orb of Tkef. And on.
Urban Dictionary, last I checked this morning, had 16 pages of definitions. My favorite one was this. Covfefe, a word used to end a tweet that should never have been started.
So, by the way, a lot of here's another one, Nesco Covfefe. What else? Having some fun with this because people, who among us has not typoed a tweet or two?
Did you hear what Spicy said?
Well, before we do that, the president himself responded, saying, "Who can figure out the meaning of Covfefe? Enjoy." So that was at 3:09 a.m. So anyway, what did Spicy say?
So Spicy said, I'm looking for it. When asked, should we be concerned about Trump having these nonsensical tweets and who else has access to that? Spicy said with a straight face, there is a small group of people who know exactly what he means.
Oh, please. Oh, Sean, please. Come on. It's just that I actually, to be honest, my fear was he'd had a stroke because it's like the murderer is. But he was in the middle of something, got distracted or whatever, and I don't know what happened. But
who has never fat fingered the keyboard?
Everybody's done this, so I'm not gonna. It is kind of a great hanging tweet, despite the constant negative press. Covfefe. that gave it a little bit more resonance. By the way, Covfefe the Strong also responded to the wizard, "Stand down, wizard. The orb is mine for the taking. Be off with you so that I may ask the orb master what he requires of me. Simpleton, the orb of Teketh is not some play toy. You would be wise to rethink your course." So this is really what Twitter was made for. In fact, I think...
Stupid jokes. Yes.
I think this is peak Twitter. We are at peak Twitter. It does not get better than this. The president of the freaking United States, the most powerful man, the leader of the free world, at a midnight tweet, Covfefe, and then he summons Covfefe the Strong, the wizard Covfefe, and they get in a battle. And that's just, oh my God.
Here's what Clinton, I'm putting
So what did Hillary say about it?
So I just put it in the other chat.
She must have been laughing. I mean, it's just, it's not, you can't get serious about this. I mean, it's just, it's just funny. All right, let me paste this in. This is from The Hill. Clinton, did she tweet?
No, I think it was at Recode.
This was at the Code conference. Here we go. Let's see
we have to get to questions from the audience, but I don't think we can get into Covfefe right now because it's a longer thing.
This is Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg talking to... Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
I thought it was a hidden message to the Russians.
Oh, you did? That is perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much for that.
That's a good get, boy, to get
that was good.
Get Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, somebody complained to me on Twitter that this was just awful because it was a private conference, but they streamed it to the world. It was great. God bless Kara.
Why would that be awful? I don't understand why.
I don't know. Snippy journalists.
What? At this point, Ms. Clinton is a private citizen. She's not bound to do anything except perhaps not pose with a chopped off head of Donald Trump. But other than that, I have not seen the picture, but I don't think I want to see the picture. So, Covfefe.
Or Fefe.
Or Covfefe. Covfefe. Covfefe.
This is the next GIF versus GIF.
It's so funny.
No, this is in 3 weeks we're gonna pull this out of the remembrance hat.
Oh, remember?
And we'll be like, what was
Covfefe?
That?
Oh, there'll be so much between here and there. You're absolutely right, Stacey. Yeah. Oh, I dread to think what the next 3 weeks hold.
What was it? Betty Davis said, "You're in for a bumpy ride." Fasten your seatbelts. We're in for a bumpy ride. I feel sad about this. I was, I'm leaving on vacation in a few days. This will be my last twig for a couple of weeks.
No!
And I'm getting ready, as I often do. This is going to be a very, it's going to be a photo expedition for Lisa and me. We're both bringing our fancy cameras and all that. And I put the software on it. And I went to the Nik collection because I love the Nik plugins. For Lightroom, and lo and behold, on the site, and actually I saw this and I didn't realize it was newsworthy, but somebody picked it up a couple of days later. The Nik collection, free and compatible with Mac OS 10.7 through 10.10, Windows Vista 7 and 8 does work with Windows 10, and Adobe Photoshop through CC 2015. We have no plans to update the collection or add new features over time. It's the death knell. This is a company Google bought a few years ago. They bought them for Snapseed, which was the app which Google does keep up to date and offers on Android and iOS. It's an excellent photo editing app. But pros really like the Nick collection. Lisa uses their silver effects, which, and many pros use it as the best black and white photography filter. But they had a lot of other great treats. So it's a little sad. But the Nick collection, it has been free since Google bought it. They turned that, it was $150, and I bought it shortly before Google gave it, started giving it away, in fact. But it is free, but it, who knows how long it will continue to work. So that's kind of sad. Lisa was complaining, actually, that SilverFX was not working reliably on the Mac.
So I'm dying to know, have you ordered an Essential?
Of course. Well, I put my name in, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was on a little bit of a buying spree. Andy Rubin's Essential, which is, of course, Andy Rubin was at Danger, right? He helped create the Sidekick. He was at Apple before that. Yep. Went to Danger with Bill Atkinson, then went on to create on his own with, you know, a company called Android, which Google bought, became the basis for the Android operating system, worked there for a long time. Remember a couple of years ago, we talked about the fact that he was leaving the Android division to do a moonshot with robots, because the guy's really into robots. His whole house is robotified. Left Google to start this secret startup, which now has kind of gone public. It's an Android phone called the Essential. And more than that, and I'm actually very interested in what you think of it, home automation unit with an open source operating system. Not like we need another one of these.
It's pretty.
It has a screen. It's apparently less dependent on the cloud, whatever that means.
It does everything locally that it can. There's some privacy functions.
Yeah, probably a response to, you know, people's concerns about Google Home and Amazon's Echo. It's Echo-like, although it also is for home automation, right? Or what do you know about it? Because there's not a lot to say. This is all we see.
So I've looked at the website. I watched part of his code, most of his code thing, and then I got called away. I'm not super thrilled about this. So this is going to come out. There's no pricing on the home thing yet. It's going to come out in June, end of June, I believe, is what they said. So we'll know more then. I feel like the phone feels very fetishistic to me in a way that I don't care about, because I'm actually not a gadget lover. Like, so when he's talking about the titanium and the 360 coverage, the only thing that I was excited about was like, ooh, stock Android. But this is just me. I know there's lots of people who looked at this and was like, ooh. So I'm really interested in how it's going to interact with the home, because what this says is he feels like you have to have a phone to work with a home, and they apparently need to work together. I wish that weren't true. I think he's right. But I tweeted a little bit about this. The focus on the gadgets feels aging to me. It's an aging idea. I want to focus on context.
Not the hardware so much.
Yeah. And I feel like there's a chance that it may do this, but we just haven't seen enough. And the context stuff is easy to say, woo, but it's really hard to deliver. And he's got a plus on the openness. He's really hitting on openness, which, Kevin, I can't wait to hear your thoughts there.
The home is convinced. Based on something called Ambient OS, which he says is going to be completely open.
Yes, and I signed up to get all the information and the SDK on that, so we'll see. But
this is a non-trivial thing to do. I mean, he hasn't been working on this that long. I'm curious what he's. I don't know. I think you just hit the nail on the head when you said fetishistic. There is a certain fetishism having to do with these gadgets, these phones, They're objects, you know, they're my precious. Mm-hmm. And I kind of agree with you. And boy, but at the same time, you know, I went kicking and screaming to cover these things. I didn't want to cover these things, but they have become the computer that everybody uses more than anything else. So we kind of have to cover it. This is where
I'm not saying it's not worth coverage. I just think I want this to fade into the background. I feel like in 50 years, we're going to look back at people clutching their phones and talking about them as like,
it's nuts.
Huh? That's weird.
Well, that's what Walt Mossberg said in his final column this week. He said, this is the future of computing is that they will disappear. They will become part of the environment.
Walt's a smart dude.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty obvious. This is where we've been going for a long time. And the computer is moving from this big centralized object to decentralized and eventually in fabric every of our lives. And machine learning will then, as part of that, as a thin layer of peanut butter on top of it, be part of our lives. And that's why voice interfaces and things like this home device are kind of, I think, going to be important, because this is how we're going to, this will be the computer interface.
Yeah, and we'll interact with voice, we'll interact with photos and images, we'll interact with other means. I like that. You know, what if the cloud were not called the cloud, or were called peanut butter? I like that.
It's everywhere. You can't get rid of it.
Kevin, do you think this is,
please go ahead.
I'm really curious on the openness. And obviously, we don't know a lot yet, but thoughts there?
He's demonstrated a belief in openness before. He's done a good job of that with Android, so he's got a track record to build on. So I'm giving the benefit of the doubt until we see the details. So we do need, you know, Android has settled down as the most successful OS we've had ever, and it has an open source base. So, you know, more power to Rubin for starting that and continuing it. I'm interested in the Internet of Things focus, and if he's actually trying to bite off the can we write an OS for all of those thing. That is sort of hinted at here in this ambient OS stuff, but there's even less, you know, information about that now. So again, very much wait and see.
Yeah. Maybe tied to the success of Android, it is also in many ways, the scariest, least secure operating system ever. And I know many people who will refuse.
Not least secure ever.
Well, no, you're right. There have been many, many, many more less insecure. However, given that...
It does have reasonable sandboxing. You know,
again and again, we hear about... Now there's we talked about it yesterday in Security Now, a fairly significant flaw that allows remote root exploits of Android devices, which Google doesn't plan to fix. More and more of a problem. And I know many people refuse to touch Android because they say it's just not secure. I mean, they say I'm going to use an iPhone instead. I don't know if that's really a good alternative, but that's what
it's the only alternative.
What else? You can use a candy bar phone from Nokia, I guess. So I think
there's no bother to exploit those anymore.
Right? Right, because nobody's going to bother to exploit that. But I think that's kind of an issue. And I don't think openness solves this or contributes to it. I want to be clear about that. Sometimes people say, "Oh yeah, that's because it's open." That's not the issue. But it is a problem. And while you could celebrate the success of Android, I think you probably should also point to the fact that it's got some really intractable security problems.
That's fair, but you know, we've seen a lot of security issues over the last, you know, since I was last on. We had the whole I don't know what it was called now, but the whole lock down the computers that was based on Windows SMB support that was left in there for several years.
Oh yeah, Windows too. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
There's always going to be a bug somewhere. It's very hard to completely secure something. And the bigger the target, the more time people will spend on it.
Well, that's the thing. This is as big a target as you can get. And one of the stories this week, Judy, a new malware on Android, may have infected 36 million Android phones. partly because it's on 41 apps that were on the Google Play Store. They're now gone. The Google Play Store's screening is not very good.
It's gotten a lot better.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's some people might disagree with you. For instance, let me see, what was the name of the malware we were talking about on Security Now yesterday? This is a terrible cautionary tale. The bug was revealed to Google 6 months, a year ago. They did nothing about it. In fact, they marked it won't fix. So the company that discovered the bug has publicized it. They even did a proof of concept where they made an app that took advantage of it. It's called the content jacking flaw. They made an app that would take advantage of it and submitted it to the Android store. It was approved in half a day, and it's still there. And the problem with this content jacking is it's a simple flaw. And I think the reason Google won't fix it is because it takes advantage of accessibility features. There's two permissions that it takes advantage of. One is the ability for one application to draw over another application, and that allows a malicious application to present a different look, something like you're logging into your Google or whatever. Very difficult to mitigate this, and Google doesn't apparently seem to want to fix it. This is just the latest in a long line of these. And the Google screening process did not catch it. They say 60% of Android users, almost a billion Android phones, are affected by this, and Google just, you know. So I only bring that up because I don't blame Andy Rubin for that.
No.
But if you're going to talk about the success of Android, you have to mention this as well. And IoT, as you know, is a big issue. Security is a big issue.
Okay. It's a different... It is. But there's... Securing a connected IoT device is kind of a different kettle of fish, and thinking about the operating system will solve some of the issues, but it's not going to solve all of them. So I feel like what we've done in smartphones isn't going to work with IoT. What we've done in smartphones hasn't worked entirely well with smartphones, but I think the stakes are a lot higher and the surface area is so much greater when we get to IoT. So it really matters. And since everything historically has been so bad, we're going to have a lot of problems until it gets better.
Great. Anyway.
That's my optimistic thing. Someone in the chat room did point out from the Verge, a Verge story where Andy Rubin did say that Ambient OS was going to be open source, and he apparently has some magic way of updating it more often.
He even kind of contests that there are issues with Android. In his talk at Code, he said, well, you know, people overstate the problem with Android. I'm not sure I agree with him on that. Well, he says Walt Mossberg pointed out that Android is fragmented and splintered and people aren't getting the updates. Mossberg said that Google's OS is forked into wildly divergent versions around the world, but Rubin countered saying the variation was actually Android's strength. Nobody gets 100% upgrades. It's impossible, Rubin said, before suggesting that Apple's purported 80% upgrade rate was actually closer to 60 or 70. He did agree Android's upgrade rate was much lower. This is from The Verge, but said that his new venture's Ambient OS had a solution for that, which he didn't explain.
Magic.
Well, he said it's more of a managed service on the back end. You know, I mean, part of the reason that it's so fragmented in Android is because you have so many manufacturers of phones, many of whom sell such cheap Android phones that they don't, you know, there's no aftermarket service. And so they don't bother pushing out updates. If he makes the essential home, and, you know, he could force updates. I mean, that's not a...
Apple also controls its silicon, which is inherently going to be more secure if you can control everything.
Well, and more to the point, Apple has the carriers by the short hairs and forces them to push the updates out, which nobody, Samsung even, can get the carriers.
I was doing my security update, I think, last week, and my phone went into the boot loop cycle, and now I have a new phone.
Nice. I know. Who gave you that new phone?
Google did, because it was still under warranty. I'm 6 months into, 6 months post Pixel, so I didn't want to buy a new phone. Right. So I just, their lawsuit was settled, I guess.
Tell you what, when I'm through with the Essential phone, I'll send it to you.
Brian, you know, I'll be bored.
I'll be bored with it within months.
Like a 360 camera.
Well, they didn't say. All you do is you sign up for it. Oh. They'll tell you.
What's Chrome OS's update rate?
Oh, Chrome OS, I'm sure, is almost 100% because
that's right.
They force it, right?
There's an interesting counterexample of an OS that does manage to update itself all the time, but that's because it's a browser-based OS, so it only works if you have a connection. So it's forcing the issue in that way.
Right, and there's no way to turn off updates. It just happens.
Well, no, I mean, you can run it without a web connection. You could.
Yes. Well, then you'd be safe. You'd also be safe. So it doesn't really matter. Yeah, no, it's like Chrome OS is just like Chrome. It gets automatic updates and it just updates itself. Yeah.
And I should say, according to, I think it was the Wired article that talked about this with the Essential, one of the things they're talking about with the Essential Home is that it's going to support like HomeKit and the Echo and Nest and all these other things.
So it will be cross-platform. That's good.
Well, so the way they did it is they reverse engineered the public APIs, which I always caution people when that happens, that's great for early adopters. But for normal people, they're going to get really pissy when, Google or Apple changes their API, their public facing API, and doesn't tell Essential, and then poof.
Yeah, that's always a bad way to do it. You want an SDK and you want an approved way of doing it instead of reverse engineering the calls.
So, and I still have questions because they threw in HomeKit, but I don't know how they're going to do that without a certification chip. So,
right.
Mystery.
So, the other thing I spent money on this morning was the Nest Cam IQ.
Oh, you doofus.
Really? I'm a doofus?
He's a doofus.
I'm giving you a doofus.
Uh-oh. I'm a goofus and a doofus.
AC doofus.
So we haven't seen anything new from Nest in a while, but we'd heard rumors of this. It's a 4K security cam, but you don't get... Nobody wants to push 4K over their Wi-Fi network. High def is bad enough. You don't want to push the 4K. So what it does is... And I've... there's the Mevo camera does this too. It has a 4K sensor, but it only takes a portion of the 4K sensor. Plus, they say, it will recognize members of your family... And let you know if the guy is creeping in the window is your brother-in-law or a bad man.
That guy was clearly bad. He was wearing all black.
Yeah, it didn't look good. Oh, but she's okay. So was this a mistake to buy this, Stacey? Don't tell, because it's expensive. It's $200.
So no, it should have been $300.
I'm sorry, $300. The second one was $200. I bought two of them.
Okay, so here's my take on this.
You as doofus. I'm a doofus. That's
I'm
your
sad
take.
For you, Leo. Okay, so
is there
I
better
have,
stuff out there? Is that
there
what you're
is.
Saying?
No. Yes. So it depends. I mean, if you want a really fancy camera, and I have not seen the Nest Cam stuff like in my life because it's not out yet. So I might, I reserve the right to come back and be like, Leo, I'm sorry I called you a doofus. But I think for most purposes, though the original Nest works fine. And my favorite camera, I happen to have it right here.
Oh.
The NetAtmo Presence. It's not hooked up to anything right now.
The NetAtmo Presence.
It costs $299.
It looks like a canary or something like that. It's one of those standalone camera devices. Yeah.
Yes. It doesn't have all the sensors like temperature and stuff. But what it does that is awesome is it does actual facial recognition, and it has for years. And it also doesn't store this on the cloud. You can upload your files to Dropbox if you want, but the default is to an SD card. So what's cool about it is it recognizes members of your family, and it does things automatically. Like when it doesn't see anyone it recognizes for a while, it's like, oh, no one's home. I'll arm the rest of the house. So I'll arm the system. So it's like the future in a lovely little camera thing that costs $300 and you don't have to send everything to the cloud. And if I were going to look at the Nest, the only thing that the Nest offers is slightly fancier, like the, I'm going to call it picture in picture, even though it's not, it's the ability to zoom in on bad stuff or interesting stuff. We'll call it that. And let's see, what else does it have?
You also have to, if you want the familiar face alerts, you have to subscribe $10 a month or $100 a year.
Right.
So,
Leo.
Yeah.
This guy.
Well, I have to review it. I know it's confusing. It appears as if I'm buying this stuff and kind of putting it all in my house in a closet. But I'm review. We want to review this. So I'm buying it for review purposes, just like the Essential phone.
Yes.
That's just my job. And I don't like to take free review units. I like to actually try these things in vivo.
I spend many, many, many dollars on
It's expensive to keep up with this crap. Six-core process. So I will look at the NetAtmo. I guess what we need you to do is a rundown of all of these.
Oh, wait. Is that an assignment coming my way?
I'm going to give you an assignment because, well, there's, and then if there's not just the NetAtmo, there's also the Canary, right?
So I like the Canary. I mean, I've tested all of these so far.
Which one do you like the best?
For facial recognition and stuff, I like the NetAtmo the best. I think the array of sensors on the Canary is really interesting and maybe more utilitarian, but if you just want camera and facial recognition... I have tried. So I didn't love the Canary Flex because it didn't play well with my Eero's.
Oh.
It doesn't play well with mesh. They said they're working with that.
That's a Stacey only problem.
This is another issue. Yeah.
Well, it's
the Canary
other, it's
didn't
other
play
mesh
well with my Eero's.
Well, the NetAtmo says it's a healthy home coach, a smart indoor climate monitor. Am I looking at the wrong thing?
Yeah, that's a different thing. That's the temperature. They have They have an outdoor weather station. And brain gauges and cool stuff. And then they have
that
and something else.
So I want the indoor security camera with face recognition.
Their outdoor security camera is really interesting too because it plugs into your existing light wiring. And then it's kind of, I don't know if I love the design, but, and then when it detects motion, that little light comes on. It's kind of like what the Ring has with this outdoor camera.
This is cool because the NetAtmo security camera will put what goes to your Apple Watch and tells you who's, who came in. Lily just came in.
They've done this for so long. These guys have been really forward thinking about how to communicate with things like notifications. So like instead of I've detected motion, they're like, hey, I saw Andrew in the kitchen. And you're like, thanks, dude.
That actually is cool. Yeah.
I love how this and the Google stuff that was shown is slowly but surely, it's a conspiracy, making facial recognition okay.
And putting it in your house.
Your house.
Keeping an eye on what you're up to.
I don't actually keep cameras in my house, I'll be honest.
You don't?
Well, how do you test these things? You tape over them?
I test them. I test them in we have the camera area. Oh. And everyone in the house knows that the camera
don't
is there.
Don't wear
for
the wigs and don't costumes near them. Yeah.
When we tested the Canary, it was a problem because its air quality sensor, the part of the house where I had it, it was like, you're going to die. It was just constantly red.
Did you keep it in the garage?
No, it was like right by our front door.
Oh,
so then I moved it. They're like, just try moving it. So I moved it and
that's pretty funny.
We're safer.
So wait, you think it was the outside air that was causing it to alarm?
It could have been just a vent blowing. I mean, who knows? That's where I keep my radiation.
Was someone barbecuing next door?
It's Austin. Somebody's always barbecuing next door.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I don't think I'm that much of a doofus.
All right, Leo. Maybe I was a little excited for effect.
You're merely adult. I didn't know, and this is why it's hard about the NetAtmo security camera. So the welcome.
I know, and they're French. Some people don't like them because
of that. They're French.
Well. Oui, oui.
Okay. Don't you think, though, that a Google company like Nest will do a better job of facial recognition? Is that just my own prejudice?
These guys have been doing it for years, and they're perfectly fine. I mean, Google's going to match it.
Google is good at it, yeah.
It is. I mean, like, I bet what's crazy, right? Right now, if like my housekeepers come in, you know, they're not, for a while, they weren't recognized. And then we recognized it because it was annoying. But how crazy will it be when your friends come into your house, the Nest recognizes them and then tells you who they are based on their Google profile?
Yeah, we have a very annoying neighbor that I would very much like to know when she comes in the house. Ah!
What does your annoying neighbor do?
She walks in.
Oh, she walks into your house?
Yeah. You know,
Alice Kravitz?
Yeah, it's kind of like.
And she doesn't.
Mrs. Kravitz? She's a little.
Here's the service. Google, when this face appears, call my phone. And then you can be like, oh my gosh, I have an emergency. Goodbye.
Yeah.
And
then, yeah.
There you go.
Well, it's funny because we've never had any security at all. And well, we had a burglar alarm, which we never arm. And I've never had any cameras in the house at all. And I never felt any need to have cameras in the house, to be honest. But I want to. Yeah. I should try these. I feel like you know what it is? It's peer pressure. Everybody, oh, you got to have a camera. Everybody's got cameras. Everybody in our family has cameras. My father-in-law has cameras at his front and his back. And my brother-in-law, same thing. And like you can't hang out with them because they're always looking at their phone going, there's somebody in my yard. And it's like, I don't want to know. Go ahead. Let them walk through my yard. It's not.
So I have two camera use cases
okay.
that I love. The Arlos, we put them upstairs on our roof. We have a roof deck. And like when it's thunderstormy, like right now in Texas, our furniture can blow all over the place. So sometimes we're like, we hear these loud thuds on the roof in the middle of the storm. And I've used the camera there to be like, oh, okay, we're good. Nothing went over. So that's one. And then two is we have doorbell cameras. And those are nice because, you know, seeing the packages and all of that. But the added bonus is when my daughter leaves when I'm out of town, she always waves at the cameras like, bye. Aww.
And I get a little alert on my app. Yeah. On my app. I kind of like that. Now, you don't use Ring. You use, well, who do you use?
So, well, right now I'm finishing up a doorbell camera review. So I have five of them.
What, really? Which one's the best one?
I can't tell you yet. The one I purchased and have normally is the August, but I don't love that one.
Okay. And there's Skybell, there's Ring.
Last year I said Skybell HD was my favorite for the wire cutter.
I remember
this year.
Yeah.
This year we're going to shake things up a little bit.
Ooh, are you doing this for the wire cutter?
Yep.
We love the wire cutter. That's awesome.
I love the wire cutter too.
Oh, good. So you can tell us what the best. I mean, there's a certain level that they all achieve, which I love the idea that I could see I can hear when somebody's at my doorbell, I can see when somebody's on my stoop, I can talk to them. All of those basic features are really great. But I'd be curious. We're, you know, obviously we have a Ring on ours, but I'd love to know what else is out there.
Do you have the Ring Pro or the Ring Ring?
I have the original Ring because I put it. Huh? Oh, I have to say they are a sponsor.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Carson's yelling at me. They're not a sponsor anymore, so no. But they were a sponsor.
At one point in time, they were a sponsor.
At one point, they were a sponsor, then they didn't pay their bills. So
oh.
They're no longer a sponsor. So, you know, you get another one, let me know. I guess that Richard Branson money doesn't go as far as you'd expect. So, I like that basic feature, but I'm curious if there's like one's better. Why would one? What would make one better than the other?
The biggest difference in them is the time it takes to have the image resolve, and then the accuracy of the motion sensors.
Yes, because sometimes that's a good point. Because sometimes somebody will come to the door, and it'll be 10 seconds before I hear them arrive.
Right,
and then it might be too late. Yeah.
And then there's things like the meat features.
Right. It has to be close enough in time so that you can answer. If they ring, if you answer and they're gone, that's not much use. But they're a little bit at the mercy of the internet on that.
They are. Yeah. I can tell you that my front doorbell, the original one that I had, hasn't worked for like.
Yeah. This is why months. Ring does so well, because nobody's doorbell works. Those things break right away.
My husband is not impressed with me. It's like, I'm sorry, when are we getting a working doorbell?
I need a doorbell. Would you stop reviewing doorbells?
So, all right. We're getting getting it done. Okay.
All right. Let's take a break. Come back with more. We're going to talk about AlphaGo. Did so well at beating the world champion at Go that it's retiring. Oh, you know how that is. It's going to then it'll go on a coming out of retirement tour, and then it'll retire again. It goes on and on. We've been there before. Google, for some reason, thinks it's going to take too much time to produce gender and salary information. This is a company with a lot of computers, right? And let's talk about Google attribution, which is starting to get a lot of attention. But right now it's snack time. Oh, boy, new Nature Box just came in. We always look forward to the Nature Boxes. And I'm sorry, those of you not in the studio, you're just going to have to suffer as I talk about the best snack company in the world. Nature Box snacks are good snacks. They're healthy snacks. They taste great. And they're better for you, created with high-quality ingredients, free from artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no artificial sweeteners, and they are delicious. Let's see. I always make sure I get the pineapple, Big Island pineapple rings. Ooh, garlic plantains. Plantain crisps seasoned with garlic. What's in here? Green plantains, non-hydrogenated vegetable oil, no trans fats, dried garlic, salt, citric acid. That's it. These are delicious. They all come in resealable packages. So as delicious as they are, you know, one of the problems with snacks is you like, well, eat the whole bag. Not this. You just eat a little bit. You seal it right back up. That's a nice feature. I like that. Now you can order, by the way, as much as you want, as often as you want. No minimum purchase required. You can cancel anytime. Blueberry almond quinoa bites. That sounds like a Stacy snack.
Oh, I'm making quinoa for tonight.
I know it.
Of course you are.
I knew it. Roasted cashews, crispy rice, pumpkin seeds, roasted almonds, dried blueberries, rice syrup, sugar, quinoa, sesame seeds, blueberries, blueberry flavors, sea salt.
Where's my box?
Yeah, you need your Nature Box.
I'm so happy when they sponsor her.
I know. We've sent you boxes, right?
You have. Oh, yeah, I love them.
We got to get one to Stacy. I apologize, Stacy. Kevin, you can't one. You're in England. We'll send you some Vegemite. No, I'm sorry, Marmite.
Okay. Pork pies, come on.
Pork pies, pasties. I love them.
Snacks, we have pork pies.
Oh, yeah, that won't kill you too fast. There are over 100 snacks to choose from, constantly adding new snacks. Choose the snacks you want to deliver them right to your door. No minimum purchase. You can cancel anytime. Naked trail mix. Oh, God, this is what I'm going to open. Peanuts, raisins, almonds, roasted pumpkin seeds, dried apples, cashews, peanut oil, and salt. That's it. New snacks every month too. Customer feedback gives them ideas. If you've got an idea, go to naturebox.com/twit. And by the way, if you ever get a snack you don't like, you go, I don't want this one. They'll send you a new one for free. You don't even send it back. Right now, you'll save even more. Nature Box is giving you 50% off your first order. Oh, that is good. When you go to naturebox.com/twit. That is the best trail mix ever. Naturebox.com/twit. 50%. This is so rude of me, I know. So mean. 50% off your first order. Jeff, you want some snacks?
Yes, please.
Crunchy barbecue twists?
Fine, I'll take anything.
Which one do you want? Pardon me? Oh, he wants my trail mix. That's a different Jeff. NatureBox.
I know.
.com.
It's always a different Jeff.
It's always another Jeff. Oh, that is good. You're going to like it. That is really good. Yeah, yeah. We'll share. Share your NatureBox. Did we talk about, I can't remember if we talked about Google Contribute last week.
No, I don't think so.
This is the one where Google, and this is, I thought we did. Maybe it was on Twit. This is the holy grail for advertisers. Google now knows.
Oh, yeah, we did.
We did know about that.
I
thought you said contribute.
What is it?
Attribute.
Not contribute. Attribute. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, we did.
Attribute?
Attribute.
I missed this one.
Attribute.
This is the credit card.
Right.
Tracking.
They can right? They can tell. They know so much about you, they can tell where a Google ad will stimulate a brick-and-mortar purchase. Terrifying. I have to say, from watching the show, that Jeff and I especially are Google fans. We love Google. But I do have to say, after Google I.O., after this, I'm starting to feel like I'm a little nervous that Google is everywhere in our lives and is becoming more and more, knows more and more about us. I'm actually starting, Jeff, talk me down. I'm getting nervous about the privacy implications of Google.
I am fine with this. I have no problem
with it. Coffee.
It's a transaction. Is it worth the value? But here's the problem. It's when you don't know. So this morning, Joe Scarborough was going on about the privacy stuff's being taken away. And so he is saying, I don't like this. And he told the story about how he started running for the first time in his life and that all he'd done was tell Mika on the phone that he was running. He insisted there was nothing else. He bought the stuff ages ago. He hadn't searched for anything. I don't believe this. But suddenly he got ads that said,
That's BS.
It's BS.
Not true.
But the point is
perception.
It's a coinkydink.
He got various ads. I think he did do something that was a signal.
Okay.
But the problem is the perception is now. Even when it is obvious, when you know the reason, when they're not watching you, enough people are going to say they're watching me, and legislators are going to go crazy about this. So they've got to be more careful about both companies about letting you know what they do, why they do it, and just be more upfront about it as it happens, so that you never get freaked. You don't get the creepy line stuff because it's valuable services. We love having this stuff.
Yeah, but it seems as if they're getting more and more data about us. Won't there be a
kind backlash?
A critical mass where they, I mean, just the fact that they can tell that
they already have that critical mass, Leo.
Yeah, they can tell you made a brick and mortar purchase based on a banner ad that was shown by Google. That's amazing, and it worries me a little bit.
So what we need, and this is, I say this every time, and I will continue to say this until it happens. We really do need some sort of bill of rights around our data and our privacy. And we have to have the government do this. And I know it sucks because government sucks and it's a painful process, but we're going to freak out until we have assurances and rules around this stuff. And we are right to freak out about it. And I wish the industry would be a little bit more proactive about it, because otherwise Google's going to face a huge backlash. And this is not, I am not a person who's like, yay, government, let's do it. But there's really no other way. We are in weird territory, and the information they have is scary. A lot of people are unaware of it, and what they are aware of is probably the worst case scenarios, which just puts them off further.
All right, Stacey, how about, don't forget, right now it's government that is getting rid of all protections. They're allowing your phone company to sell stuff. This government ain't going to do that.
I am well aware, yes.
It's her senators. It's Cornyn and Cruz.
Yeah.
Yes, they're lovely people.
I think there could be almost kind of a constitutional convention around this. If a university, I don't mean mine, convened people across various sectors of society to start to come up with standards for this. I think that's a legitimate thing to do, because otherwise what's going to happen is we will get the regulation that Europe brings.
And it should be international. I mean, these should be things that are.
I don't want China's, Iran's, Brazil's.
All right. Well, regulations.
But see, this is the problem. The internet is international.
Yeah.
Right.
But there's no international consensus on what privacy should be protected and what shouldn't.
And as hard as that is for the companies, I don't want consensus.
European rules. Yeah.
So go ahead, Kevin.
So we tend to get the American rules rather than the European rules. So the American companies will say, right, well, the way to do this is the way that we've considered it in America a lot of the time. And that is changing as their markets move, but that's historically.
What is the status of things like ISP privacy? You know, in the United States, we're dealing with two things right now. One, the repeal of the FCC decision to make ISPs ask our permission before they share our information with marketers. And two, of course, we're looking at a repeal of any net neutrality regulations. There's even a bill in Congress to force that. What is the status of that in the UK? I know you're actually dealing now with not just the Snoopers Charter, but an even more draconian proposal from both the conservatives and the liberals.
And well, more from the conservatives than from Labour. But that's they're making part of the election campaign at the moment. Is you know, the Home Secretary was in the debate tonight saying we want to intercept more things and we want to be able to break encryption. And it's, you know, they're in some ways they're asking for the impossible, but that's the position they've been taking for a while. The other thing that we've got is the European data protection directives that are coming through, and because of the Brexit stuff, UK companies are humming and hawing about those, but they're still going to come in before we leave, and it would make sense for them to follow along with them anyway. So that, I think that is that what you're meaning by we're getting European regulations, Jim?
Yeah,
GDPR, is that what it's called, Kevin?
GDPR,
that's right,
yes.
Yeah.
It may next year.
This is a really big law with teeth because it's a huge fine. It's like, is it 20% or 10% of your revenue or a minimum fine of like a crazy amount? I'm trying to remember.
Stacey, in my book, Public Parts, not to plug that, but I argued that government portrays itself as your great protector of privacy, but government is the worst threat to privacy because government has, through the IRS and police and so on, all kinds of means to exploit your privacy against you that no one else has. So
they do,
I'm just saying I don't trust government to do it, and I think that self-regulation from the companies themselves doesn't work because no one's going to, you know, Facebook comes out with new privacy stuff and everybody's suspicious. So I think I'm agreeing with you. And I'm not saying government shouldn't have a seat at the table, but I think it'd be better if there were some kind of independent organization that the companies agreed to join in and endorsed self-regulatory standards.
I worry that the teeth, there's no teeth there. The economic incentive to abuse someone's data or a group of people's data is pretty high. And so I feel like you've got to have a pretty big stick to beat them over the head with. And self-regulation doesn't have that. And the government should have rules allowing, like dictating what it can access too. And we don't even have that.
I was part of a group, pardon me for this, Davos, that went through privacy. And there were a lot of, and so people like Vivian Redding, who I've, mm-hmm. lambasted from the EU were at these sessions, and others from the FTC and so on. And there was a lot of persuasive work there that says that advances we could make in medical data could be thwarted badly by privacy, and that we have to also sell the advantages of sharing, that we can't just concentrate on what goes wrong. Number one, we've got to also look at the positives here so we know what we're balancing. And then number two, what was number two? I had a number two. I swear I had a number two.
Number one's bad enough.
Yeah, was it? So we have to look at the advantages. We have to look at actual harm. The creepy mm-hmm. line cannot be used as the basis. Oh, that would be creepy. That is meaningless and is a dangerous standard. There's just something about that. Is not a standard for regulation. So you have to go to actual harm. And then I can start to get behind it. But again, I know I'm sounding like a libertarian. I'm not. Everybody knows, and I'll get complaints on Twitter tomorrow about even saying that I'm a Democrat. But in this way, I have my libertarian streak that I don't trust government to be smart enough, to be future thinking enough, to understand it systematically. But you're absolutely right. The companies aren't doing it either. So I think Leo needs to call a privacy convention.
I'm just glad I'm going to be dead in a few years because I don't think there's a solution for this. This is just a mess.
It is. And I would say, Jeff, I agree. And there are efforts like to donate your data to medical science. And those kind of things are awesome. Mm. But
in that case, you give informed consent.
Yeah, and it's not just donations, Stacey. I'm going to disagree there. I think that's not enough. That's not enough data. If you have a confluence of cancer in a geographic area, then you find out that there's an old...
from hospitals. You get that data from doctors.
No, not with HIPAA right now. No, it gets locked down in every which way. And no, there's too much fear of letting any of this stuff loose. So we don't compile it because of the fear of privacy, because we've gone overboard with the fear.
This is
we
a website
sold the benefits enough.
Called the Recode Project. Thank you, Kevin, for posting this in the chat room. Policy recommendations for open access to research data in Europe.
Yes.
Seems like a good idea, but is there support for this, Kevin?
This is one of the things that there's being talked about in, you know, along with the GDPR stuff. And so the researchers are talking about exactly what you're saying. They're saying, just as you carry an organ donor card, you should carry a data donor card and say that your data can be used for medical research. And they want to encourage people to think about it in those terms and then put some constraints about, you know, some corresponding things to make sure it does comply with GDPR. The challenge is always anonymizing it well enough. And that's always been extremely hard, because for the data to be useful for medical research, you need to have those, you know, you need to know that which hospital was it from, and at which point you can get to the patients fairly easy and de-anonymize it again. So it's not a straightforward problem. It is very hard to do, but there's a lot of people trying to think about it. The GDPR stuff, I think that's there's a bunch of pieces around that make a lot of sense, and they're trying really hard to make these things coherent. But it's awkward when this is combined with the kind of surveillance stuff that the government is pushing here, because that tends to be done in this sort of covert way that breaks all the rules, and that has, you know, that was the concrete thing where hoarding vulnerabilities led to hospitals closing across the UK.
I don't get the sense that GDPR is aimed at governments, though. It's aimed at private businesses, isn't it?
It's both. Yes.
Really?
It's both.
I mean, what is 4% of the annual global turnover of a government? Yeah.
but the point is the rules and the thinking about it is supposed to apply to government institutions as well.
This, by the way, is law and will go into effect almost a year from now, May of next year, May 25th.
And you give up 4% of your revenue if you're in violation, which if you're a large enough company, and you can get fined 2% for not having your records in order.
This is going to be used as a cudgel. Publishers are going to allege GDPR violations against Facebook and Google in a flash. Yeah, I predict it.
Some of this stuff, I mean, I can't disagree with. Under the GDPR, breach notification is mandatory where a data breach is likely to result in a risk for rights and freedoms of individuals within 72 hours. I mean, look how long Yahoo sat on its breach.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Well, yeah. But did they know? They're too stupid to know.
The right to be forgotten, that's one that's challenging because it changes the way the internet works. Data portability, I think that's a good thing. Privacy by design, I think that's a good thing. Data protection.
Well, that's an
privacy by design is a really hard thing to talk about.
Yeah, it is.
So here's a question, because this is something I think about a lot, because this is such a thorny issue. And we've never historically, we haven't regulated this way, but with privacy violations, should we be thinking about regulating by outcome in terms of like, and again, this is hard, but like, I know that if I donate my data to medicine, I'm cool with it going to help cure cancer. I'm really not cool with an insurance firm using that data against me to charge me more or just to deny me insurance, for example.
So this is where you there's kind of a blockchain of your data, what permissions you've given. Complex, but there's a possible structure there. Yes, I agree.
So because these are the things, like when you use data for redlining, you're like, well, that's crappy, but
yes,
that data is good for other reasons.
But here's the caution, Stacey.
But the corollary to redlining is saying which hospitals are bad. Yeah, so if you know. If you the redlining thing is like, okay, which hospitals for which areas are bad, and is there bad coverage in particular neighborhoods, and so you end up doing that. You need to do that kind of research to say actually this hospital has the bad treatment practices that we need to attack, and so you end up having to have that kind of geocoding data attached to it as well. So you know it and it does depend on transparency for the how the data is used as well. And that is much harder to achieve. And it's particularly hard when you're using machine learning on it, because a lot of the time they can't actually give you any transparency back. You know, if you're using data set policy, that's great, but you need to say how you're using it as well. And then you can expose the kind of, you know, treatment-based discrimination or neighborhood-based discrimination or, you know, pre-existing condition-based discrimination stuff. But, you know, that's the trade-off. It's hard.
Yeah, and it's really hard to – I think that your AI point is important, Kevin, because you know, this data point has these conditions attached to it, but we don't know what we could learn from that data in future systems. And part of what Europe looked at was – not limiting it when it comes to research. But then again, private companies are coming. Google is coming up with things that can help people. I don't think it's just that academic researchers are okay and Google's not. That's a wrong presumption too. It's information. At the end of the day, I think we have to keep in mind something here, that information flowing freely in society is a good thing.
But it's not.
And we need the conditions that enable it. Oh, but
it is not always a good thing for everyone.
I didn't say always.
And that's the challenge we have here, yeah. Is information is not a benign thing. It's power. And right now, consumers and individuals have very little power over their information. And that is legitimately frightening for them, because they are being manipulated. They are being, you know, paying a price for things that otherwise they may not. And
gotta talk about the positives of information and knowledge at the same time. If all we do is concentrate on the bad that could happen, then this is how we end up in this discussion. This is why I wrote a book about this, because I was so concerned. Nobody bought it, but that's another problem.
I'll go read it.
I'll send it to you. Because there's a balance to be struck. And the discussion now is almost entirely on the fear side and the what can go wrong side, and not on the positive benefits side. There's a societal benefit that comes at some level.
There is. And I talk about that a lot with like IoT when people diss on IoT. I look at things like creating true energy efficiency across, you know, neighborhoods and cities. And there are so many benefits to applying this, but those are hard to talk about when there are so many people trying to use it for perhaps material gain. And maybe we just need better publicizing of this other, the positive things. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is, again, I agree with you, Jeff. It's super hard.
It is really challenging. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is so? Kevin says, "Did you see Stephen Fry's speech? What did Mr. Fry talk about? Last I heard from him, he was getting off Twitter because everybody was mean.
So he gave a very long speech at the Hay on Wye Book Festival about the future technology
and Gutenberg.
And Gutenberg. Oh no, I gotta watch it. I gotta watch it.
He covers the 95 theses. Gutenberg. Wow.
Oh Lord.
So Jeff would enjoy this, but we may need to go away and read it and talk about it next week or something. But it's
read it. Read it.
Well, there's a transcript on Stephen Fry's site.
No, there's a transcript.
I don't see it.
I linked to the transcript. I think there is a video, but he
want his delivery. But anyway, go ahead, Kevin. Sorry.
It is long.
The thing is that it's long, but he was talking to a literary festival, which is kind of the fun part of this. And he's talking to them about tech and being the interpreter of tech to them. So and he doesn't come out with a lot of great recommendations. His answer is this is kind of hard as well, but we don't want to just leave it to the tech companies to think about this, but the rest of us need to pay attention too. I think that's the sort of high level thing of his speech. And the challenge is that we don't necessarily want the reaction to how we use all this to be decided by a small group of people who live on the West Coast of America. And that's part of this. You need to think about how else you use it as well. Because their worldview may not match everyone else's. And I think that's kind of what you were trying to say, Stacey, is that A lot of data is good, but it's a lot less worrying if you're already relatively comfortable, relatively powerful, and it's much more worrying if someone can use it to have power over you. And that's the piece that's very hard.
Here's just a little excerpt from his speech. He's talking about...
I submit that it's nothing short of scandalous to be in the middle of a general election in 2017 on the very brink of this awe-inspiring, terrifying, scarcely credible, but unquestionably real and imminent revolution, and find that politicians are skating not to where the puck is going to be, not even to where the puck is, but as ever, to where the puck used to be. Westminster's record is pretty grim in this. Thank you. So, I would just say, you can argue convincingly that one of Churchill's greatest qualities, one which helped him perhaps turn the tide of the Second World War, was his openness to science and technological development, as shown in a Science Museum exhibition a few years ago dedicated to his role in that sphere. The development of radar, which he supported, was, of course, a vital part of the victory in the skies in 1940. Sonar, too, was of incalculable importance in the Battle of the Atlantic. Churchill always listened to his scientific advisor, Lord Charwell, whom he called the scientific lobe of my brain. He got behind wonderful inventions and developments like the bouncing bomb and Operation Windows, gyroscopes. And, of course, he sent that famous five-word note concerning mysterious money that was disappearing into Dollis Hill and Bletchley Park and that the Treasury couldn't understand. Churchill had gone to visit the Colossus vacuum tube computer Tommy Flowers was building to help decrypt Enigma. When he came back after having seen it, he wrote a five-word note. Give them what they want. That short note could be regarded as one of the founding documents of digital computing. But, of course, you could justly observe that so did Hitler exhibit a loving and a belief in science. And that is, of course, true. As Churchill himself, in one of his best-known speeches, said, if we fail in the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, we'll sink into the abyss of a new dark age. More sinister,
he's good.
And perhaps more protracted.
I think he's a professional.
There's a Churchill Ryan movie Laurie. Coming out. He should have played Churchill.
And so bear ourselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And but to complain about the neutrality is technology will work for wicked people and for saints. As Marshall McLuhan observed, to complain about it is as witless as cussing a buzzsaw for lopping off your fingers and complaining that you never saw it coming. The witlessness of our leaders and of ourselves, and I include myself, is indeed a problem. The real danger, surely, is not technology, but technophobic canutism, a belief that we can control, change, or stem the technological tide instead of understanding that we need to learn how to harness it. Driving cars, after all, is dangerous, but we developed driving lesson requirements, traffic controls, seat belts, maintenance protocols, proximity centers, emission standards, all kinds of ways of mitigating the danger so as not to deny ourselves the life-changing benefits of motoring. We understand why Ned Ludd destroyed the weaving machines that were threatening his occupation. We understand why French workers took their clogs, their sabots, as they called them, and threw them into the machinery to jam it up, giving us the word sabotage. But we know that they were, in the end, if you'll pardon the phrase, pissing into the wind. No technology has ever been stopped. So what is the thesis I am nailing up? Well, there's no authority for me to protest against, no equivalent of Pope Leo X for it to be delivered to. I'm certainly no Martin Luther. The only thesis I can think worth nailing up is absurdly simple. It is a cry as much from the heart as from the head, and it is just one word. Prepare. We have an advantage over our hunter-gatherer and farming ancestors, for whether it is winter that is coming or a new spring is entirely in our hands, so long as we prepare. Unlike Martin Luther, I thank you for your indulgence. Thank you very much.
Stephen Fry, that's the coda of his speech at the Hay Festival. It's an hour long. You can actually watch the whole video.
It's on the BBC.
Yeah, the BBC has it.
I couldn't find it.
If I just Googled Hay Festival, Stephen Fry, and
it's actually at the bottom of the transcript.
Yeah. That's not in the transcript?
No, so the bottom of the transcript, that link I just put in is
yeah,
there.
Because, of course, it's the end of the speech. But I think it's a good coda to our discussion.
I don't find it.
Yeah.
It's not obvious what the answer is, but we still have to prepare.
But the thing that I liked about it, I didn't see all of it live, but I did read the transcript, was him saying, we need to be thinking about this, we need to be paying attention to this, this stuff is important.
Right.
And just reactively making mapping it to your current talking points is a shame, and it's particularly a shame as you watch the UK election progress that's broadly what's happening with the tech part of
it's also encouraging. And he makes the point, and I think this is really great, that we did do this with cars, that there is a yes. there's a precedent for this. It's as intractable yeah. as this seems to me. You know, we've done it before, and we do need to do it. We can't just sit and let it just happened, which
we have spent
maybe what happens, but
decades thinking our government is stupid, it's incapable of doing things, and that it's bad. And it feels not that we're as naive maybe as people were in the 60s, but if we expect better, we might be able to get better. And I agree with you. I'm stupid, but
no.
It's a hard argument to make right now, though, isn't it, Stacey?
Well,
it is, but this is why I'm not leaving. Like, there's so much of me that's like, let's abandon ship and go to Europe or Canada or somewhere. I can, but I can't because I have faith in people. Right. I have to.
Right.
I don't know.
And I do think that government is the only chance for solving this is government. You know, I understand your caveats, Jeff, but who else? And government, in its best sense, reflects our interests as a society. And it's our interests as a society that need to be protected.
This is where Eric Schmidt would say, would you rather have government run Google or Google run Google? And I would rather have Google run Google.
I think that's a false argument.
Yes, it is. It's specious. Go ahead, Stacey.
No, that was all I was going to say.
Yeah, it's specious because Google can run Google, but it can't run Google without any unfettered. There should be.
No, I agree with
Larry Page wanted to move to an island because he didn't like anybody to say, tell Google what to do. But that's, sorry, Google exists in a society. And let's not use the word government. Let's use the word society. Google exists in a society.
Well,
and society
but they're different,
has.
They're different, Leo. It's government right now.
They're different because government is imperfect.
Your privacy rights more than anyone is. Government right now that's taking away all your privacy.
Well, the point of an election is to find out what people want.
Well, yeah, we're there.
And they voted.
That's exactly why, I'm a liberal, but in this case, I'll trust the market more.
Well, only because you don't like what the people said, huh?
No. This goes back further. Because I believe that right now, the key change here, and this was in What Would Google Do? I'm in Plug Day, was that now that everyone can complain loudly about any company, the public, forget market for a second, then the public's ability to keep a company honest is greater than it's ever been. And if you are, this is the genesis of don't be evil, right? Being evil is bad business because you'll get caught and it's going to be trouble. So that's not to say that I agree that we need a broader discussion with more constituents, with more guidelines possible, with more opportunities to hold somebody against a known standard. I agree with all of that, but I do think the market is in better shape now to fight back against companies.
If I get back against government?
Companies.
Badly behaving companies. Yes. They are if they know.
The market has no solutions for badly. That's why we have antitrust law. The
Bill
market
O'Reilly
is no solution
would,
for
Bill
poorly
O'Reilly
behaved companies.
Bill O'Reilly would.
Okay, Bill O'Reilly is a very different thing, and he's been. He's been in the press. There
even
are data
the most
brokers.
Conservative people agree that there should be antitrust regulation.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with that, Leo. I'm not arguing with that, but
this
I'm the
okay,
essential
so
solution
not,
here.
Not antitrust, but there's so much happening that people don't know about. That the hard stuff, think about all the good reporting that goes on that people don't pay attention to because it's, God, it's so boring. But those are the kind of things that public outrage doesn't solve because it's esoteric. It's hard. I look at things like pharmaceutical pricing, lack of markets for vaccines or new antibiotics, just in that one industry.
Right? That's why journalism should exist.
Well, I'm not saying that journalism can't do it alone. Sure. Like, I looked at the Texas Tribune in Texas. They did this amazing thing about half a year ago about a child exploitation in sex workers. Our legislature went in and just did nothing about it, despite the fact that this is great journalism about it. Completely, there were actual things that could solve it. And our legislature was like, eh.
Well, you can always bring up counterexamples, but what? But
sure.
So I'll try to depoliticize it by using society instead of government. I understand. Do we not, as a society, have an interest in protecting our interests against corporations? Corporations have their interests, and we have our interests. And do we not have a right as society to say to corporations, okay, you can do this,
but what are the mechanisms to do that?
Well, we only have one mechanism. Government is a reflection of society. I understand it's not perfect, but what else is there?
No, we also have market-based solutions.
Market doesn't do anything.
Market doesn't care about consumers unless you're in a...
Are you an Adam Smith market fan?
No, I'm saying that there are multiple... I am so distrustful of government at this second. This is the irony of this, right? And I'm going to get such crap. People on Twitter, relax. You know I'm liberal. Just let me be liberal, okay? I'm me.
This isn't even liberal. This is you're saying it's the invisible hand.
I get all kinds of crap. Leave the politics off of Twig. Let's go back to Twig, which is fine. We can do that in 2 minutes.
You're quoting Bill O'Reilly now. I don't know who I'm talking to.
No, I'm not. There's a paradox here. The paradox
Tim O'Reilly
anti-government forces won, and that's why I don't trust government.
No, the reason.
Okay, but they don't give up, Jeff. Good Lord. You're going to end up on an island in the middle of nowhere.
But don't give up on the public and the other mechanisms. Don't give up on the public pressure that can be put by the people, by the public.
Don't give up solely on government. Don't give up solely on government.
Government is a tool of the people. A government is a tool of the people.
I'm not handing it all over to them.
Yeah.
And look, I got to say, Stacey, your point about privacy is right, but look who's ruining privacy in the United States of America today. It is the government.
It's data brokers, it's Uber,
it's a lot of people.
And the government is enabling them now. The government is not protecting.
And the worst fear, of course, is a collusion between private industry, especially Google and Facebook and maybe and government. That would be the worst case scenario. I agree. I mean, if we have a government that is and we kind of do have a government at this point that is run by money, in other words, run by big corporations, it doesn't do a very good job of protecting societal interests. But I don't know what other tools we have. You think that consumers could just rise up? I don't see consumers saying, I'm not going to use Google anymore.
So, I mean, OK, I was a teenage libertarian. So,
is that like a teenage werewolf?
That's an intellectual horror movie. Yes.
Back in the UK in the 70s, there was this like government is doing too much. The trade unions have too much power. There's a big problem with society running. And at that point, the libertarian point of view, the Hayekian free market point of view, was not getting much of a hearing, and it was an attractive alternative. And that gave us Thatcher and Reagan. Picked up a version of that and it solved the problem of trade unions having too much power. But we're now at the other end of that cycle, and we now have the situation where the corporations have too much power, and they have the same lack of empathy with normal people that the trade unions had here in the 1970s. And so we're having this weird election going on here now, where there is the neoliberal consensus that sort of Blair took on board from the conservatives and said the way to do this is to encourage the city to do the right thing and to do that rather than to nationalize everything. That consensus has broken down, and the Labour Party is campaigning strongly on a nationalization, on a more control of services
by the government because people see that corporations aren't doing a good job of it. And that is getting a lot of resonance. That, you know, they've picked up a huge swing in the polls once May called the election and Corbyn started appearing on TV and saying these kinds of things. So we are seeing a swing back against that neoliberal consensus. And it is wrong footing a lot of us because we're used to that idea of the markets delivering, but at the same time, we can see these kinds of flaws where people have too much power. Margaret Thatcher famously said, "The trouble with socialism is eventually run out of other people's money." But that's kind of where we are with financialism. Eventually, the city runs out of other people's money. Eventually, the venture capitalists run out of other people's money, and these things start failing as well. And we need to step back and say, how do we balance these two points of view? And what it comes down to is, how do we think about people and how they're treated, and not chase the abstractions too far?
All right.
I was just trying to end on a high note with Stephen Fry, but I obviously stirred up.
Let's get back to worshiping technology, please.
I have a great segue for you. So here's the segue. Let's see if we want to pick this up.
Before you do the segue, I want to do an ad. So I have some capitalism. Okay. But tell us what your segue will be, and then I'll do the ad, and then we'll do it.
I was like, your ad's going to mess with my segue.
Oh, man. You got your segue in my ad.
So here's an example of the private interests not necessarily aligning with consumer interests, as Reed Hastings talked today at the Code Conference about his changing perspective of net neutrality.
Oh, wow. What did he say? Ooh. Oh, well, we'll find out after this
there
word.
You go.
That's not a segue, it's a tease.
That's a really good tease. Now I'm dying to know what happens. Our show today, how about a little capitalism? I'll just mix it in here with a little corporatism along with that libertarianism. There's a great guy who is an absolute capitalist. His name is Jay Walker. You probably know him as the guy who created Priceline. If you don't, well, now you do. I asked him when I talked to him, I said, are you the guy who hired William Shatner? He said, yep. Jay's a great entrepreneur. And as with the best entrepreneurs, he sold Priceline. He can't take it easy. He decided after his non-competes wore out, there must be another area that we could disintermediate. There must be some thing that's not working in the world in travel that we could make better. And he found it. Business travel. If you're in a big company, you have a travel department. You call them up. They make your travel plans for you. They have pre-negotiated prices with the airlines, with the hotels. The company likes it because the company knows it's going to get the best deal. You like it because you don't have to do any work. It's a win all around. But if you're not in a big company, how does it work? Now you're doing your travel booking. The company itself maybe isn't real happy with what you've booked. First class all the way. And you're not getting the advantage of pre-negotiated rates. That's where Upside comes in. Jay's new company, Upside.com, the better way to buy business travel. Upside is very simple. Pick your destination. What's nice is they've got pre-negotiated prices with a variety of airlines and a variety of hotels. It will offer you the best six deals right off the top. Now, if you want more, you can do more, all curated. You get to choose the hotel, you get to choose the airline, you get to choose your flight time. There's no mystery here. The other thing you get a gift card. Now, if you're the owner of the business, you can apply the gift card right away and save even more on your flight and on your hotel. But if you're booking for your company, for your travel, the company's paying for it, company's going to get a great deal, but you can keep the gift card. And gift cards can be $100, $200, $300 more if you're traveling overseas. And it's gift cards with great companies like Amazon, Target, Nordstrom, 50 of the best brands. You'll get your gift card within 72 hours after booking your trip. It's a win all around. You get a gift card, your company saves, and you get great business travel. Plus, 24/7 concierge-level customer service. You can call them, email them, chat with them, reach out on social before, during, and after every single trip. You're going to save hundreds. Your business is going to save hundreds. You get a gift card. It is a great idea. The best way to book business travel, Upside.com. Get a $100 minimum gift card on your first trip by using the promo code TWIG. That's minimum. You'll get at least $100 if you use the promo code TWIG on your first travel. That's Upside.com, promo code TWIG. Save big on travel and get a big gift card every trip. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. Upside.com. Twitter.com. All right, Stacey. What the heck are you talking about?
So, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings at the Code Conference said that basically net neutrality, he's not big on it this time around because
it's overblown.
He's big enough. Well, he says, quote, it's not narrowly important to us because we're big enough to get the deals we
want.
Well,
that's right. Whoa. That's the point.
So basically he's like, thanks
Bingo.
For last time. Moving right along.
Bingo.
Jeez.
Well, it isn't.
You timed
all right.
that well, Stacey.
It's fair. It's win. Not his battle. It's fair. But you would think that as somebody who came up on the internet that he would like to keep, instead of pulling the ladder up after him, keep the internet free and open for the next guy.
But they've been big enough to do their own peering agreements for years. Right. That's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, of course.
And once they had that big kerfuffle with Comcast, they won that and did their own peering with them, they were like, all right, we're good.
Although, wasn't it Comcast that turned the dial down on Netflix to squeeze them?
So what they did, all right. So what they did is they blocked certain ports.
Right.
And then they
didn't buy more cables.
They didn't connect more ports for them. But they did say when Comcast, so Netflix said, hey, we will offload this stuff for you because we have our own CDN boxes that will hold our content. So this doesn't even have to be a problem for you. You've got so many people, we'll just stick our boxes in your data centers near the customer. Comcast was like, no, we don't want to manage other people's boxes. If we do it for you, we got to do it for everybody. Meanwhile, Comcast comes back to them and is like, here, you can send all your traffic to the following two data centers to serve our entire user base around the countries. And Netflix was like, oh, hell no, that is not a good deal for us. And that's super complicated and expensive. And so then they got in this massive fight. It was highly technical. And the bottom line is the FCC started to get interested because they were like, dude, guys, work this out. And I think, didn't John Oliver do something on it too?
Yeah, oh yeah, I think so.
I was very excited because I was a peering nerd. I am still a peering nerd. And you
that's
talk
a complicated
about
subject, man. That, if you understand that, I'm impressed.
Nanog conferences. I love them. So basically the point now is, you know, Netflix and Comcast, they've done their deal. Yeah, they're, as you said, they're pulling the ladder up behind them. Yeah. It's frustrating. And even in D.C., in talking to people about this, like at South by Southwest, they were like, no one wants to expend the capital in this. This is not an issue for Google and the guys who fought it last time.
Right. That's what's sad anymore. Because it's it affects Twit. It affects the next Twit. Anybody who uses the internet, I mean, I can easily see a situation where Comcast says, well, it won't cost you anything to watch Netflix or Amazon. But if you want to watch a video podcast from Twit, well, we're going to have to, you know, that's another matter entirely. We're either going to slow it down or it's going to count against your small bandwidth cap. Forget Twit. I already, you know, I'm already made my business. What about the next guy who's just starting out?
Yeah.
Keep Our Net Free, which is a pro-net neutrality website, is created. It's a little bit of a propaganda Chrome extension called a Removal of Net Neutrality Simulator. If you want to install it, the net gets slow all of a sudden. When you go to Facebook, it says, maybe you'd prefer MySpace. When should I add it? I don't know. It's going to screw up my internet really bad. Okay, so let's see what. Want to stop the internet from becoming a reality? Voice or concerns? Let's see if I what happens.
It's a look thing. Okay.
Yeah. Let's see what happens if I go to Facebook.com. Does it get? Oh, this website does not function correctly on your ISP service. Please use MySpace instead. Now, that's a little bit agitprop. I don't think it's really going to be like that, but it's going to be much more subtle. And what's bad is people aren't going to even notice, I think.
Well, I mean, that's a historic joke in that, if you remember who bought MySpace, but that's,
Rupert MySpace Murdoch, right?
bought by Rupert Murdoch, who owns both TV companies and NetSwitches. So
So
I'm not sure if this is fully related, but it is kind of connect. It joins the thread back. And it's another UK theme thing. So there's a story coming on in the UK at the moment in that the top song on the charts is going to not be able to play it on the chart show because it's a protest song calling the Prime Minister a liar.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting thing where it's like.
And it's number one, even though it got no radio airplay.
It's number one. I'm not sure it's quite number one on iTunes yet, but it's, I think, across. Because they now count iTunes and YouTube plays and social media things in the charts, it's going to be number one in the charts, and they're not going to be able to play it on the radio because they're in an election and they've got a duty to not play partisan songs.
That's why they're not playing it. Oh,
yeah.
So it's like a fairness doctrine.
Yeah, we eliminated
there's a fairness
that.
Doctrine here. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Now the way it works here is you can't buy airtime, but there are rules about. Each party that is fielding enough candidates is given party political broadcasts that are put on the air.
Well, I can play it.
We have a mission to make Britain a country that works, not for the privileged and not for the few, but for every one of our citizens. And together, we...
Is that Nigel Farage?
No, that's...
Boris. That's Boris Johnson.
Boris, yeah.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, I don't think you'd have seen this on CNN if it had been Hillary either. She's a liar, liar. Oh, she's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. Number one on Apple's iTunes charts, apparently. Like Captain Ska. She's a liar, liar.
Wow. So, I mean, I'm not sure how that quite plays into this. I mean, it's an interesting counterpoint to the difference between the way things work here and there. In the States, they would have played that as a commercial.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
They would have said, yes, we'll play it as a commercial. Here, it's a grassroots thing that someone has put together on YouTube, and people are buying it because they find it funny. And there's a great British tradition of that as well. There's a whole Christmas number one thing we can get into. But
although we did, CNN did fire Kathy Griffin
for
a photo which I did not see and I am not looking for and I do not want to see of I don't know something negative. I know what it was. I just I don't even want to say it.
You don't describe it. Okay.
No. Please.
So you play. Okay. You play
it was a little over the top, shall we say?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It was, and she realized it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She felt bad about it, but CNN fired her. Here's an interesting sidelight on how privacy actually can help. Turns out, an interesting study at Harvard, when Wikipedia switched to HTTPS. Which made it impossible for governments to see what stories you were reading, it turns out there was a direct connection to less government censorship. Because governments don't want to block all of Wikipedia. They would like to just block the articles about Tiananmen Square. Well, I guess Turkey doesn't mind blocking it all, but most countries are censoring bits and pieces about it.
Well, mostly they want to censor a particular thing, but they end up blocking all of it.
That's the only way you could do it.
Happened in the UK because there was an argument about is this album cover child pornography, and the block all child pornography list added all of Wikipedia for a few days till they realized that was not quite what they should be doing.
Right. The study, after a painstaking, this is from Motherboard, painstakingly long process of manual analysis of potential censorship events, the researchers found that globally, Wikipedia's switch to HTTPS had a positive effect on the number of censorship events. Because they can't see into what you're looking at.
Right.
So there's an argument for privacy. When governments don't know what you're reading, they're less likely to censor it. Chipotle says most of its restaurants, I think you might want to say all of its restaurants, were infected with credit card stealing malware.
I am so sad. This means I'm going to have to change my credit card again.
Good Lord. The malware searched for track data, which sometimes has cardholder name in addition to card number expiration date and an internal verification code on the magnetic stripe of a payment card as it was being routed through the point of sale device. But there, here's the good news. They got your name, your card number, your expiration date, and the internal verification code. But Chipotle said, but there's no indication other customer information was affected. Oh, well, never mind.
What else do they have?
They got your all
she
your
likes guacamole.
Yeah, right. So the company suggests you file a... Okay, wait a minute. Check whether you're... were you at a Chipotle between March 24th and April 18th, 2017, or another chain they own called Pizzeria Locale?
No,
if so, the company suggests you file a police report.
Jesus.
Contact the Federal Trade Commission or place a fraud alert or security freeze on your bank account.
Good God.
Chipotle
your
is
bank
not.
Account.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know why.
If it was a debit card.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Chipotle is not legally required to offer credit protection for affected customers. So, I love this, though.
No. Not even in the even in the state of California?
I'm just quoting The Verge. Nat Guerin. He calls it exe.coli. I'm starting to feel bad for Chipotle. I figure the credit card companies, you know, will back you up.
I mean, my credit card, I think I'm on like my third one of the, in the last year. It's become.
But remember what happened with the Target breaches. The credit card companies were so pissed off at Target, they sued them because they had to send out new credit cards or they had to make the losses good. So they sued them and it cost Target a lot of money. I can't remember the number, but it was a very big number.
They don't even need to do that. They can just turn up their fees.
Right.
They can say, okay. You know, you're now in the 7% bucket rather than the 2% bucket.
Right.
Although then they'll just pass that on to the consumer. They'll be like, we don't take credit cards. And then consumers will be like.
No matter what. We pay for it if it goes, if it costs Visa money, it costs Chipotle money, if it costs Target money, they don't lose money. They just charge us more.
Yep.
Adam Smith's invisible hand.
What?
Huh? Adam Smith? Google has added a personal tab to your searches. This is, as far as I can tell, just an easy way to a fast way to search your Gmail. So I bought a mail signing certificate from Global Sign. So I'm gonna search for Global Sign, and then under more, I can make it. Let's get personal. I'm gonna get personal, and then you could show this. There's nothing. This is in my Gmail. This is the back and forth with Global Sign.
So Gmail is different, but haven't they done something similar? Like I know sometimes when I search for things, it gives me like information that based on information they have about me. And it's like only you can see this result.
It says from Google products, Gmail, Google Calendar, and Google Plus.
But they've mixed one boxes in that do that for a while. Yes. So if you search for someone in your contacts, you'll get their phone number, but it says this isn't a Google result. This is from your contacts. The kind of thing. And it does a bit more on Android as well, because Android the Google app there has insight into bits of your phone that isn't necessarily there on the web version. But they've done this for a while, but making it a tab just for that is interesting. That's saying this is actually searching your Gmail, actually searching your Google accounts. And it's giving you a reason to have a Google account as well, which is the other half of that.
So I searched for a Comcast, and on the personal results, there's a bill as well, right? Purchases, as well as Comcast email. And if I had an appointment with a Comcast technician, that would show up there too, if it's on my
computer. So they could be like, unroll me, and I could say eventually, I could be like, gee, how much did I spend at Amazon? And it would be like,
well, there's services that will do that if you sign up for them. They'll go through.
I know.
Yeah, like enrollment.
Wait, we haven't talked about Google and its inability to discuss how it pays people, and we need to do that.
Oh, yes.
We need to talk about that one. Oh, yes.
Yes. So,
sorry, I'm not letting that go.
No, you're absolutely right. We got to mention this.
Yep.
So, you want to tell the story, Stacey, while I pull up the link?
I may not tell the history. Exactly right.
The history.
So, the Department of Labor is suing to get data from Google on how it pays female employees because it's concerned that it is paying them less and is discriminating against them.
Right.
I don't remember the law it's using.
But Google says, we can't give you that information. Here's the story from the Register, which, of course, in its typical snarky way, says
snarky.
Google can't spare 113 seconds of revenue to compile data on its gender pay gap. Google said it would cost them $100,000 to figure out whether they underpaid women. To compile accurate wage data to compare women's income to men's income would be 500 hours of staff time. So, okay. I don't know. You know what? I have a feeling that the Labor Department's not going to accept that excuse. Right. But we'll see.
No one in Texas is accepting that excuse either. And ex-Googlers is definitely mocking them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They spend $150 million. They have a $150 million diversity program.
Yeah, I was like, how much have they donated to Girls Who Code or Black Girls Code?
They shouldn't spend that on it, but how much have they spent on the salary of the HR manager who's completely failed to improve their hiring practices?
Right. Well, do we know if Google pays women less than men? That would be a shameful thing.
Yes.
Well, I think that's what they do is the thought process, and this is the data they're trying to get.
Right.
So broadly, they do, yes, measurably, and it's similar to the other companies in that they hire women at lower wages, at lower slots. They promote them less well, and the attrition rate is higher, so fewer of them end up as managers. Google does have some senior women and has had a lot of senior women, but their promotion system has been bad. Kelly Ellis has written about this a few times and said, you know, concretely, the system that they use doesn't necessarily, because it uses performance ratings and existing salaries, it means that any bias that starts is baked in and is continued. So she came out of college and was hired into front-end development because she was a woman, even though she had experience in back-end. Because they decided that would be the right place to put her. And
right.
She didn't know. And then to actually get through the promotion process, you have to show that you've overperformed and so on. So the actual process is very difficult. I mean, there's a long series of posts that she wrote about this.
Department of Labor said the investigation is not completed. But at this point, the department has received compelling evidence of very significant discrimination against women in the most common positions at Google headquarters. So they're looking for, more evidence from Google. Google says, well, we can't afford to compile that information for you, which sounds to me like...
From a company that has data.
Yeah, it sounds to me like...
Right. Yeah, it's like,
we don't want to
really, Google.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a federal contractor. So one of the issues is, as a federal contractor, they're required to give the Department of Labor access to records and information about compliance. So that's one of the issues. So Google has to, as a governmental contractor.
This is like you can index the entire web, but you can't actually look at your own employee database.
Kind of hard to believe, yeah. Kind of hard to believe.
That is the challenge. And, hopefully the government doesn't let them off the hook. And I know Google is not the only one, but...
You would think Google, of all companies, would
that's why this is so interesting.
People equally and be merit-focused and not gender-focused and look at a coder. I understand really probably some of this anyway is what you were saying, Kevin, which is it's just kind of a quirk of historicity, or maybe even you could blame the previous employer because they...
Well, it's just bias.
No,
it's bias.
Google, no one at Google is like, we are not going to pay women equally.
Right.
Most people at Google are probably like,
what? Yeah.
They have to be forced into record. Like, realizing this and doing something about it. And then, you know, because if you can say,
stonewalling is not the solution, Google.
No, it never is. I mean,
no. Yeah. I mean, it is. It is more complicated than equal pay, equal work. It's also more opportunities for women and minorities for better, higher jobs. Yes. So how you analyze this, it needs to be on both fronts.
Promotion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, churn, things like that. I mean, there are tons of things that, I mean, as a woman who has worked in startup environments in tech, there are tons of things that can push you out if you don't have the support network at home. Right. If you're not working with people who are actively supporting you and trying to push things ahead, I mean, there are a million days that you can wake up as a woman in tech and say, you know what? I just don't want to deal with this bull anymore. And
I just want to say that my wife makes more money than I do. So, I mean, but the thing is you'd expect Google, of all the companies, to be like bending over backwards.
Yeah.
I took this picture at Google I.O. when you sign up for your badge. They say, we care about your pronouns. Add a sticker to your badge to tell them whether you are they, them, or she, her, or he, they. I mean, it's they act as if they are really open-minded and really care and really progressive.
Well, but they're trying. You know, they have an internal culture that is trying to build this stuff, of course. The women in Google groups and the Gaglers and all those kind of organizations exist. But at the same time, they think that they are naturally immune to this because they're so rational and don't introspect it and don't actually measure it very well. And that's why I was linking to Kelly's thing, because Kelly was saying exactly this. Subconsciously, they will decide that the guy who looks like me is a better coder than the guy who looks than Kelly who's
Google's CFO, who is a woman, Ruth Porat, answering Kara's Swisher at the code conference.
Question I'm going to ask is about the Google salary, right? Why will not you pay $100,000, whatever? Why will you won't give this information to the federal government?
So I think what you're asking about is the Department of Labor has through their federal contracting office is doing an audit about gender pay equity. We are very committed to gender pay equity. Mm-hmm. We've done a ton of data analysis and looked at job families and levels, and based on that have said...
Including equity, because that's really...
Including equity, absolutely, full comp. And based on all of the analysis, are very comfortable, confident, saying we don't have a gender pay equity.
Well, yeah. I'm so glad for you to say that, but why not release it?
And so we have given the Department of Labor hundreds of thousands of records, millions of data pieces of data, and the lawyers at this point are saying, you know, this next round of requests is actually looking for personal contact information from thousands of our employees, and our view is that it's too much. And so, having given them hundreds of thousands of records and millions of data points, our view is that they have what they need, and we're leaving it with the lawyers.
Well, if you have all this data proving this, why don't you put up a big splashy website explaining how great you are?
I think we have. I mean, the way we've done
you guys like data, right? I'm pretty certain you like data.
I mean, the data we've looked at, again, looks across its job, family, level, performance rate, the whole host of things, and it's on that basis that...
Have you ever thought of releasing that data to people to show this? Because one of the arguments was we didn't want to pay for it. Is that incorrect?
They did do a report, by the way, gender
equity.
They
do a diversity report and a gender equity report, yes.
They released that information of some kind. Good for Kara for digging in on that. But I think maybe Ruth Porat's response is...
Go ahead.
Go on, Kevin. No, go on.
She's giving the company line, the party line, but she's not. But the challenge, someone at Google started compiling a spreadsheet of internal salaries and breaking it down by gender and race. And Google shut that down so fast you would not believe. And the woman who started it is no longer working at Google.
Right.
Because they're really, really sensitive about it because it doesn't actually line up well. You remember that.
Yep.
It happens over and over again. And the challenge is it's not the, you can always find one or two, supposed counterexamples, like the CFO is a woman, and you know, and so on. But if you actually look at the experience day to day of all the employees, it doesn't work out that way. And it's very hard to show that without actually having the conversation with the people who've suffered under it, particularly in a company that is all about. As you say, its internal image is that they don't do this kind of thing. So right. When this kind of thing does happen, people get away with it because they think that couldn't possibly happen.
Right.
And the stuff that the Susan Foster talked about at Uber is way more egregious than people have said at Google. But the same kinds of things and the same trends are there, and it happens at a lot of these companies. And it is a structural problem.
Stacey, what were you going to say?
No, basically, less eloquently, exactly what Kevin said. So there we
there
have
you
it.
Go.
And
well,
if we want to solve the structural problem, Jeff, we're going to go full circle. We're going to have to go back to the government.
Government.
And we're going to have to do government. Things like child
this is the
care
government.
And support.
That's the point.
Yeah, Department of Labor.
Well, but you do that. So. You do that. And if you, you know, you, the, you existing laws, you have to go to Congress. You have to do things that. I mean, I don't argue with that.
No. Google says it is so good. It is so good at machine learning that it is now blocking 99.9% of spam and phishing messages in Gmail.
It's also blocking a lot of other things.
I still see spam. I get a lot, and Lisa gets a lot of those messages. My name is Raimondo. What you doing?
My favorite is Google blocks the White House because I signed up for the White House emails.
And they
so
block
those
it?
Actually go into spam for me.
Wow.
And I've never done anything about it. So I'm guessing other people
you could
are
reverse
like,
that. You could reverse
I,
that.
I can. No, yeah. But the point is, like, if you don't check your spam, you're going to get
you
some.
Should.
It sends all kinds of crazy stuff.
50, according to Google, 50 to 70% of messages, that seems like a broad range, but 50 to 70% of messages Gmail receives are spam.
Right. So if they're only blocking 99.9% of them, there's still a lot of messages left.
Yeah. I think Gmail does a very good job in spam.
It does.
I do.
It does.
I love Gmail as a product. It is a wonderful product. I even pay for it. I have the same issues Jeff does because of that, but you know, I'm cool.
Yep.
So do you want to tie that up to the people using AMP to get around this?
Oh, no, really? They're using AMP to spam?
Because AMP has a Google.com address.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Because they're caching things.
Oh.
It was the stories. Some of the fishers are, you know, putting up their AMP site, marking up with AMP, getting it cached in the Google CDN, and then sending that link to people.
Jesus.
It's somewhere, but I can't find it now. Hang on.
I do, Jeff. You'll be happy to know I turned on AMP on my WordPress.com blog.
Oh my!
Yes. Well, it was just a little plug-in. I checked a box and that was it.
That's fine. So it's there now. Yes.
Yeah.
So I want your view on this. So publishers have been begging Facebook, and Google's been pushing Facebook to recognize the AMP standard, and Facebook took a step that way today, but
yes.
It strikes me as one way, not the other way. You can publish instant articles on Facebook and then hit buttons to have it go to AMP and instant articles. But I think what people were asking for was kind of the opposite as well, that instant articles would be AMP compliant. No?
No, I think, well, it depends which way around you look at it. So Facebook has a tool that lets you generate instant articles, and now they're also generating AMP pages.
Yes.
So it's that's nice. So you're saying that they should also read AMP pages and present those inside Facebook, which I think they
what
do.
If, what if you're already set up to make AMP pages in your CMS, which you can do, right? WordPress. Right. Leo's example, WordPress. So he sets it up to automatically create AMP, but that doesn't do them any good in terms of getting that into instant articles. So you want it to be compliant going that way, right? You want it both ways.
Well,
it's a nice thing Facebook did. I'm not denying that. But I could imagine in Leo's exact case, you want it to go the other way as well. No?
Yeah.
Am I crazy?
No, that makes sense.
I think part of it is that AMP is slightly more general than instant articles. So instant articles is you have to put these particular bits of markup in and then we'll recognize it as an instant article. Whereas AMP is... Here's, you know, AMP is more, if you put any of these up, these bits of mark, I mean, it isn't AMP, otherwise it is AMP.
So you right, see and so, so, so Kevin, so one then is the other thing
one
is
exclusive standard. Yeah.
And AMP has more functionality. I mean, Instant Articles has more available functionality than AMP does. AMP is a subset of both HTML and, in a sense, Instant Articles. So that
no, not sure that's really true. So Instant Articles, as I recall it, is their own sort of subset of browser functionality that they will use to render it in the Facebook style. But you have to mark it up with a set of classes that says, or a set of elements even. So you have to have a certain set of elements in it. Otherwise, it won't be recognized as an Instant Article. It'll fail the validator.
Good news, Austin. Uber and Lyft are coming back. Monday.
And I just got a coupon from Fasten telling me to use it, which was the competitor that started up.
Oh, wow.
I just got it 2 minutes
ago. One of the three. I did too. Look at you. Share my code. Save your friends. this will be interesting to play out.
The state overruled Austin's.
I'm so pissed off about that. So, for a variety of reasons, not necessarily related to Uber, that and the sanctuary cities legislation, SB4, that caused the brawl in the Capitol.
I went down to the state house when that last time I was in Austin. They have a big statue on the way down there celebrating states' rights, which, of course, is, as you know, is code for slavery. And I'm just thinking, well, maybe they should have city rights, too.
You know, the time our governor at the time of our decision to secede was from Connecticut, and he actually did not want to secede. So he actually left the governorship of Texas over the issue of succession.
Wow.
So, fun fact I learned because I went on a duck tour this weekend.
A duck tour?
Yes.
Oh, you rode the little Austin duck buses that go in the water? Would you have family visiting?
No, my daughter had never done one, and I love duck tours. I do them in every city I go to that has one.
Really? You recommend them?
Really? You're a duck tour connoisseur?
If that's
what
a thing.
What is it you like about them, that they go from the land into the water?
No, I like quacking at people. I'm a very enthusiastic quacker.
Wait a minute. When you're on a duck tour, they give you a duck call and encourage you to quack?
Oh, yeah, my duck caller's downstairs, but yeah, you go, quack, quack, quack.
Oh, wait. You have a duck collar?
It's not a real duck collar like a hunter would use. It's a Google this.
I just want to say, in San Francisco, we chased the ducks out of San Francisco.
Oh, I believe it. So yeah, all these people have these little duck bill things that you just quack. I'm sure eventually you'll see a picture of people
doing
this.
Like a hunter thing. I was hoping for a Stacey Bird Calls show.
No. But if I had my quacker, I would be enthusiastically quacking right now. There they are.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God. I have never ridden a duck tour.
Oh, really? Is that irritating?
Yeah.
Oh, guys are just feeling like you're too cool. These are super fun. It is on a lanyard, and you see people in the street and...
I didn't
Everybody
know that
goes,
you got quack, a little quack, quack. Duck thing. That's hysterical.
Austin Duck Adventures is a fun narrated tour that goes all around the great city of Austin. It's the perfect day outing for adults, kids, seniors, really anyone alive.
I want to see the duck.
You're going to have a 75-minute tour that goes all the way around downtown Austin. Your tour guide is going to show you all of the great places that we know and love, such as the Capitol, the Driscoll. You're going to go by the
slavery statue.
And then everybody's favorite part, you're going to take a splash into Lake Austin. It's great. You're going to go all the way around the lake. We're going to see the hill country.
These are powered by biodiesel,
Austin
too.
Yes. It means they smell like a French fry.
Do you see the Robert E. Lee statue that's still up in Austin?
Oh, Lord. All right. Yeah. Did you know the governor of Texas seceded from the state before it seceded from the union? Did you know that?
Our tour guide actually worked at Disney before he worked at Duck Tours. So I didn't realize this was
Look,
a career.
There's a hippo.
I'm trying to imagine one of those here. That'd be great.
Speaking of Uber, Eric Holder's report is supposedly coming this week. former attorney general, was hired by Uber to figure out what the hell is going on there. So that'll be interesting. And Uber has fired Corey Lewandowski, the engineer that was the center of controversy. I'm sorry, Anthony Lewandowski.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Corey Lewandowski never,
to work in the White House.
Never went to work for Uber, although that would have been pretty funny. Anthony Lewandowski, no relation. Or is he? Maybe he is. We don't
Lewandowski,
know.
Lewandowski. Lewandowski.
Yeah. Levin, right? It's the same name. That's an Ellis Island.
I think the Uber culture and the White House would work pretty well together. Yeah. Okay.
So he was the engineer that they hired from Waymo. Actually, he quit Google to start Otto, which is a truck company. Then Uber bought Otto. And supposedly, these very top secret Waymo LiDAR technology, he stole from Google and brought it over with him. And, of course, there was a big court case. Google sued. Uber has agreed to pay $600. No, that's not Google. They haven't agreed to anything. But Lewandowski was ordered to hand over evidence. He asserted his Fifth Amendment right to avoid self-incrimination. He has continued to refuse. So even though the court can't do anything, Uber has fired him. So Fifth Amendment doesn't work. Just a little tip. In employment matters, can't plead the Fifth.
Well, you can, but...
They can still fire you. I refuse to hand over any employment information on the grounds that it might incriminate me.
It's kind of like the people who argue free speech when they get fired for saying something reprehensible.
Right.
So there you go.
Doesn't protect you there either. anything else I've missed?
We're there.
We're there. Believe it or not, we're towards the end of the program.
Yeah, I had something. What was it?
There's so much good stuff. This was a full... The first...
There was Mary Meeker's 2017 Internet Trends Report.
Oh, God, that'll take us a year. That is 800 slides.
Sorry, we can do it next week.
We could do a whole show on her trend report.
She did say that 10 million...
Is there good stuff in here?
10 million Amazon Echoes have been sold, according to her.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a lot.
But that's according to her, not...
She's a Kleiner Perkins, and she does this yearly slide deck. This year, 355 slides. And everybody looks at this because she's pretty perceptive, right?
Yeah.
And she has a great team of researchers gathering data.
Yeah, she's got a lot of data.
It's basically sort of pre-verified facts for you to use in your presentations for next year. So... And also approved by KP. So if you're going to pitch them, you could say, "Well, Mary Meeker's slide says,
according to Mary Meeker,
this is this big."
Does she? It's her Internet Trends Report. She's done it for some years. Does she do this? What is the point? Does she do this?
She started it at Morgan Stanley, and she was the analyst who I think it was Morgan Stanley. She was the analyst who, way back in 2000 or 1999, was like, "The internet, it's going to be big." And a lot of companies are going to put money into it, but only a few big companies are going to last. And then she accurately pinpointed PayPal and Amazon and a couple others.
Oracle. She is a
prophet.
Prophet.
I was going to call her a Cassandra, but she is actually not a Cassandra.
No, that's the wrong kind. She's
wrong one.
Yeah. She's the one wrong that three. Inhales natural gas.
No, she's like...
What's that?
Pythia. No,
the Oracle of Delphi.
Delphi.
She's more like the court astrologer. You know,
that's a little closer, actually. Yeah. She kills a sheep. She reads the entrails. Global smartphone growth is slowing. Smartphone shipments grew 3% last year.
This is not new. This is what we're talking about. Sorry.
This is Norvig's law. It's like, you know Norvig's law.
No, I don't.
Once half of people have something, it never doubles again.
Well, of course. It's called math.
This is where we're with cell phones. We've kind of crossed the point
where
the growth can continue at the same rate because you're running out of people to sell them to. And Leo can only bug the trend by having 50 for so long.
Right. Voice is beginning to replace typing in online queries. 20% of mobile queries made by voice in 2016. Accuracy is now about 95% unless you use Siri.
Google has shared those stats, not this I.O., but last Google.
In 10 years, Netflix went from zero to more than 30% of home entertainment revenue in the U.S., while TV viewership continues to decline.
What? Give that to me again.
Netflix went from, in 10 years...
30% of home entertainment revenue goes to Netflix?
That seems like a lot, doesn't it?
With when there's HBO...
I think she means subscription revenue. Well, they have more subscribers than HBO.
Even then, there's cable.
But a lot of people aren't cable lost. I actually just got an email. It was like 890,000 people... subscriptions in the last, here we go. Major pay TV providers lost about 795,000 subscribers. Oh, this is from March even. I bet I have a more recent one.
There's like 100 million TV homes though. I mean, it's...
I know, but they've been declining.
You know what? Thank you for actually using your brain, Jeff. That number does seem a little wrong.
Maybe they summarized it wrong. I'll bet they summarized it wrong.
I bet that's right. This is.
If we could only find that slide,
recode
so that would take us.
Well, if you don't have the PDF, you can grep it, can't you?
I am not grepping Mary Meeker. I'm sorry.
Grepping? I just don't want. I don't want to know. I'm not even going to Google it.
It stands for General Regular Expression Parser, as I remember.
Oh God! Yeah. Okay,
and it is—it's called search in more normal,
unless
code friendly households. That's definitely Stacy's.
That's mine. My family just got home.
Yeah. Oh.
I can get a quacker up here if you need one.
Yeah. You don't need any. You don't need any cameras down there. You got
the
dog.
Percentage here. Hang on. Okay.
I can't get the slide deck open.
Monthly minutes, just under the PDF. That works better than trying to use the crappy embedded thing.
Yeah.
Network TV minutes delivered. Okay. Netflix.
These slides. It's like, and I bet she goes through them. Like, there's 300 some of them. I bet she goes through them like one per every 3 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, let me tell you about Global Smart Show Ownership. And now let's talk about Smart Throne Install Base. And now let's talk about Internet Usage Engagement. Solid growth plus 4% year over year mobile 3 hours. Good Lord.
Yeah, so I'm searching for Netflix to try and find this figure. Oh, here we go. Netflix streaming from 0% to greater than 30% of home revenue in 10 years, USA. Yeah.
So it wasn't misquoted.
And yes.
What slide number is that, Kevin?
I don't know. I'm on the PDF. How do I tell?
Average number of slides.
162.
Okay, Leo.
That's
actually fewer than normal.
162. Okay.
That's only that far in. Yeah. I feel so informed.
can you absorb this?
Just do Command F Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Netflix. I need to grip it. Netflix streaming. Yes. Share represented by Netflix domestic streaming revenue over total home entertainment revenue in the USA. Domestic streaming not broken out as an individual segment.
I still don't believe it.
Netflix streaming graph only shows streaming subs thereafter.
Okay, hang on.
Netflix paid subscribers is that solid green line.
Paid subscribers. Oh, I hate these double.
It's on the left. That's millions. Yeah. So it's
and then share of USA home revenue.
Yeah, this is like, oh my God, this is nuts.
Okay, so
the bad graphic.
This she's got to go to Edward Tufte's seminar and work on this. But you know what? What she says. I have never watched her speak. I'm sure what she does is she says, "Well, let me tell you what this slide means." In a few words, I would hope.
You'll see the video from Code from her. But, I mean, Netflix is, for our TV, we buy, if I don't count Amazon Prime, because I get that with my $99 Prime thing, Netflix is the only thing. And sometimes on months that we use Hulu, we re-up our Hulu, but that's it.
Right.
So.
This actually is, it's really fun to read this, but it just, you know, set aside a day. Facebook platform monthly active users global months since launch. The green line. I can telestrate this. The fast growing green line is Facebook. The red line is Instagram. I don't know. Actually, you can't really tell anything from this. I don't know what it.
It's all going up, man. It's all going up.
Up and to the right. It's all the graphs are up and to the right.
To the right. General. Oh, here's good. Generational media usage. The chasm is increasing,
And the totally true.
The shift to internet-delivered content is increasing. Mobile device time per day has doubled over the last 2 years. Here's the traditional cable conundrum. Channels plus consumer prices plus programming costs are rising, but subscribers are falling. That's a traditional cable conundrum.
Those aren't things you can
I've
add
been
up.
Writing about that since 2009.
Those are not. I think we need some type checking. Some type checking here. This is not. Those are not. Crowd Justice. Do you know about Crowd Justice? This is big in the UK. It's a Kickstarter for court cases. It's coming to the US.
Wow.
Oh, hang on. Is this a different one? This isn't the guy who was solving the parking tickets. Is this another one?
No. This is a different one. Users have taken cases to the Supreme Court in Britain and won them all. It was used to raise funds to battle gerrymandering and Trump's travel ban in the United States. They just raised $2 million in, but that's not much, in a round led by Venrock and First Round Capital for moving into the U.S.
Huh,
it's like GoFundMe for court cases.
So it's not actual class action. So the U.S. No. has class actions, which the U.K. doesn't.
No. Yeah.
Which is the lawyers decide to put you in a class and fight for you and then keep most of the money.
Right. This is individuals saying, help me fight, you know, like Mike Hallett, who's known as Pirate Joe. Pirate Joe is being sued by Trader Joe's. He made a business of buying Trader Joe products in bulk and reselling them in Canada.
Or Mike Masnick.
Oh,
that could help.
Yeah, that'd be good. Mike Masnick, who's fighting the fight against that guy who claims to have invented email 20 years after it was actually invented.
Oh, don't get in the middle of that one.
I was like, careful, Leo.
I didn't say his name.
You and Mike soon might have a class.
I know, really. I'm really excited about this. I spent many hours on CompuServe playing something called Colossal Cave Adventure.
Yes. Yes, so did I.
Yeah, originally Crowther and Woods Adventure. I think this is the 651-point version, if you know what I mean. And I mean, I was taking a phone and plunging it into rubber cups on a 300 baud modem to play this thing. You are at the end of a road before a small brick building. Around you is a forest. A small stream flows out of the building and down a gully. If you played Zork, you played a derivative of this, but this was originally developed in 1976 in Fortran, I believe. Oh,
I started playing it in 81.
Eric Raymond, open source god, uploaded the game's code to GitLab. This is awesome. Oh my god. This is so extensive. This is a forward port of Crowther Woods Adventure 2.5 from 1995.
Wow.
Wow. Oh, it's written in C. Here's the README. The authors have given permission and encouragement for this release. Oh, there's a history file too. I've got a little compiling to do. Maybe a little grepping. I might do some grepping before I do some compiling.
Oh man, I'm trying to remember. My first thing was when I was a kid, sitting in my dad's lap as he played. Is it Wizard and the Princess? Maybe.
Oh wow!
It was like one of those.
Yeah.
So, and I started playing that with him, as a really small kid. Once I could read.
That makes me feel very old, Stacey. Thank you very much.
Here is by the way.
I'm sorry.
One more stat from Mary Meeker. Last year, 60% of the most highly valued tech companies were founded by first or second generation immigrants. And hire and employ 1.5 million Americans, including Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, and Facebook. Okay? Immigrants, we get the job done. Actually, I'm a Mayflower descendant, so I can't say that. Well, I guess we're immigrants too. Just a long time ago.
I was a first generation immigrant until I left.
Yeah, you were. That's right. Yeah. I really do think we have now covered the board. Everything of interest.
Mm-hmm. Elon Musk might quit the advisory board over
he
Paris.
He has tweeted that if he drops out of the Paris... If what? Oh, you were going to get by without that one, right?
Oh, no. I'm just Jeff, I'm getting hungry.
Oh, Jeff, don't bring up any more.
Things are going to start happening.
She's getting faint. She's getting faint. This is all over the Paris Accords. Let's take a break, and then you can do a pick, and then you can go eat. What's for dinner tonight, Stacey?
Oh, you guys are not going to like it. It's a kale and quinoa salad.
Oh, you need Blue Apron, my friend.
There's a segue.
You need to go to blueapron.com/twig and get your first three meals free. That's what you need. I am having a delicious Blue Apron meal tonight. I think it's blackened pork. I love Blue Apron. So the idea of Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. What you do, it's not a subscription. You go on the site and you pick your meals. This is the two-person plan, for great for couples. Or, you know, it would work for you, Andrew, and your daughter, Stacey, because we do that. Michael, we split it three ways, and there's usually enough.
It feeds so many.
Yeah, it's so good. Caramelized onion grilled cheese sandwiches. Oh, this looks so good. With the summer squash and celery salsa. Thing is, you're going to, make some stuff you've made before. I can make grilled cheese sandwiches, but did you ever try it with melty fontina and caramelized Vidalia onions? Maybe not. Persian-style chicken and crispy rice. I love the international flavors. I've learned so many great new ingredients. They send you everything you need, including the meat, the fish, fresh, never frozen, and exactly what you need. In fact, I'll show you this recipe. This is what you get. You get a half cup of jasmine rice, a half cup of Greek yogurt, a pink lemon. Now, what's a pink lemon? That sounds good. Summer squash, yellow onion. You get just, 2 tablespoons of butter, not more. So there's no waste. You have exactly what you need. The menu, the recipe comes with pictures on a really nice 8.5 by 11 card. It's sealed. So you can follow along, do it yourself. You'll feel great. 40 minutes later, you've made an amazing meal for yourself or your family or your loved one. And you've done it at a much lower cost. In fact, grocery stores cost about 60% more than Blue Apron because they don't have all the overhead of a grocery store. What's on the family menu?
And you have all the spoilage.
Right. This is always
all the stuff you don't, you buy bigger things. I made a pumpkin chiffon pie when I was trying to woo young women early on in my days. And it cost me like $25 because I had to buy pepper.
Right. Right.
So I had to buy everything.
Right.
You don't do that with
blue. You didn't have pepper?
That was
not the first time.
My wife was unimpressed with my discovery that kitchen cabinets were the exact right size to store New York Times's.
Oh, Lord, you're kidding. Oh, my God.
Go ahead, Leo. I didn't need it.
Sorry, Leo.
You put your newspaper in the cupboard? Oh, my God. How about chicken schnitzel with fingerling potato salad and marinated Napa cabbage? Or this is the family plants. Greek spinach and feta cheese pies.
Ooh, you make those?
Yes.
Make those? Wow.
It's like their take on spanakopita, which I love. And look, you get everything you need to make it. Oh, I love this. This is Blue Apron is so awesome. Look, here's what we're going to do for you. We're going to get you your first three meals free and free shipping. And remember, it's not a subscription, so there's no commitment. You can just try it. Go to blueapron.com/twig. blueapron.com/twig. I love it. I saw Lisa has our Blue Apron box in her office. I saw it came today. I love it when we get the new Blue Apron. You know what we've been doing, which is really nice, is she gets three recipes. Two she knows we're going to want, and one she wants to give to her parents. So her parents, it's really sweet. Her parents live in town, and we just bring it over there, and they love it. And they, her mom cooks it up, and it's delicious. Blue Apron would be a great gift for somebody. blueapron.com/twig. We thank them for their support of This Week in Google. Why don't we let Stacey get out of here? You got a thing this week, Stacey?
I'm sorry, you guys. I'm like wine, and then here's Kevin. Like it's.
I know you're hungry. Midnight? It's okay. I know you're hungry.
I'm a whiner. Okay, so mine is really easy. I don't have a thing this week because I was busy breaking doorbells, but I do have, and it totally relates to our conversation. I have a great newsletter for you guys. If you are interested in digital privacy and digital rights. This is from my former colleague, both at Fortune and at GigaOM, David Mayer. He is based out of Germany. It's a weekly newsletter. It's called Connected Rights.
Oh, this is great. Oh, I have to read this. Oh, this is awesome.
You can stick it in your spam newsletter file, Leo, along with mine.
I know.
This is it's a good summary. It might make you angry.
It's quick.
So I love it. I like it. Maybe you will too.
Very nice. And how can you find it? Just Google Connected Rights, I guess. Connected Rights newsletter.
I put a link in. Let's see if Connected Rights.
Weird link.
It's not a really pretty link, but
yeah.
No, he's at Superglaze on Twitter. So let's see. Let's find a good link.
Yeah, it's like EEPURL. You know, I'm telling you, Google.
He's got at Connected Rights.
Okay, on Twitter. There you go.
There you go.
Okay.
Right. Very nice.
Well, just subscribe to the feed, so let's see if that shows up.
Yeah.
There you go. So,
Kevin,
useful.
Kevin has got some indie web stuff for us, I'm sure.
Of course. There are 20 spots left at the IndieWeb Summit. So if you go to 2017.indieweb.org, you can sign up there. This is in Portland, June 24th to 25th. And I probably won't be there, but a lot of my people I know and like will be, and I'll be watching it over the internet because you can do that too. So if you can't actually make it to Portland at the end of the month and next month.
This is great. Look at all the names in the indie web. Tontek and Aaron and Ben Werdmuller, and they're all there.
You've met a bunch of these guys already.
Oh, yeah. I love them all. I love the indie web. I'm all in on the indie web.
And I've got a kind of fun thing for you.
Okay.
So this is RoboVision, imagery.pathnonsoftware.com. You've got to give it a picture. And it will feed it to three different image recognition thingies and decide what they are. So give it a photograph of something that you would like to have.
Okay. There's a picture of Jeff Jarvis. Facial hair. Person. Hair. Book. Text. Human. People. It's still recognizing.
I have hair.
There's a third one. Hang on. That's coming in, but it's a bit slower.
So there, Google, and then I don't know what a recognition with a K, but it's German probably. And CloudSight sees man in black and purple collared blazer.
Collared blazer.
Collared.
So I'm fairly sure CloudSight is actually somebody typing stuff in that they see.
Ah, that's why it takes so long. So they obviously don't know the difference between collared and collars.
Or they're a bad speller.
They're a bad speller. That's really interesting. Yeah, that kind of, they gave away their humanity there.
They gave away the humanity there. So
yeah. RoboVision at imagery.parthenonsoftware.com. Thank you, Kevin. Jeff, we already did Meeker's numbers.
Right, no, I was just there. I was going to do a Swiss man as opposed to a Florida man. A Swiss man was fined, lost in court, 4,000 francs, $4,100, for liking defamatory posts on Facebook.
What?
Really liking them.
No.
This was a crazy story. Lord.
It is. But since we just did the spelling joke, we should probably also do the Google Trends here. America's most misspelled words.
That is my most misspelled word. I totally fit the profile in Texas.
In Texas, maintenance.
Misspelled?
I can never spell maintenance.
But how come Jersey can't spell 12?
12.
Oh, what 12 about 12. Sense? Or angel?
So this is, by the way, one of the greatest features of Google, and the one I probably use the most is if I can't spell a word, I just type it into Google, and it said, did you mean beautiful? Because you spell it B-O-O. What is this what is this Arizona can't spell? I can't read it.
Banana?
It looks like banana. Arizona, you can't spell banana?
B.
Oh, that's New Mexico. Arizona can't spell tomorrow. That's true. Tomorrow. I know that. Of course, the Scripps National Spelling Bee is now underway, so you should practice your spelling.
I like that Maine is pneumonia.
isn't Washington State also pneumonia?
Oh, here's a better quality map. Here we go. This is much better quality.
Like, who can't spell quote?
Huh?
Quote.
quote.
Some of these are baffling.
It's interesting. Oklahoma can't spell patient. Is that Oklahoma? I wish they put the names of the states on here.
Oklahoma is right north of Texas. Yes.
Yeah.
That is Oklahoma.
What state is that that can't spell Chihuahua?
Is that Georgia? No.
And,
is that Georgia?
And by the way, in Vermont, they can't spell diarrhea. It's funny that Maine can't spell. Maine and Vermont, there's something related there. And in New Hampshire, they can't spell Europe.
Pennsylvania sauerkraut.
This is fun. Hallelujah is a problem in several states, of course. Pneumonia is a problem in several states as well. In Florida,
gray
they can't...
versus gray. That's okay. Gray versus gray is a problem.
How can you not spell gray?
Well, there's G-R-E-Y and G-R-E.
Do you think they spell it G-R-E-Y in Alabama? Really? Is that the problem?
Ooh.
I'm suspicious. Of course, it's a good thing I'm not in South Dakota because they can't spell that. No, that's not South Dakota. What is that? Montana? What is it? Nebraska. When'd you win the state, name the state contest, Carsten, in eighth grade?
Geography.
Geography. I hate it. Whenever it's geography on Jeopardy, I just go, I'm done. I'm out of here.
Wait a second. Wisconsin can't spell Wisconsin?
Yeah, everybody's been mocking Wisconsin all day.
They can't spell Wisconsin. OMG. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is a great time to end this hoot nanny.
Thank you. I heard Stacey's stomach rumbling.
Yeah. Stacey's stomach is rumbling. Either that or her dog is barking. They sound the same.
No, she's quiet behind me.
IOTpodcast.com. Whoa. Yeah, I see her. That's just sweetie. Get on down there and enjoy that fine quinoa and kale salad.
It's delicious.
It sounds great. It sounds very healthy.
Did your family just come back from McDonald's? Is that where they were?
No, this is my daughter's favorite. My 10-year-old daughter's favorite meal is kale and quinoa salad.
Now, what do you dress it with?
It's like a Caesar salad with dressing with lots of garlic, and you massage it, and you put the quinoa in.
You have to with the kale, because kale will be tough if you don't massage it.
Yeah,
Do you use Valerie Bertinelli's recipe?
I use something from the internet. I use Eating Well massage kale or massage kale salad.
Salad from Eating Well. Wow, that sounds
I think that's
great.
Illegal in three states.
You have to massage kale. It's tough otherwise. I just think that that's a reasonable thing. There it is, eatingwell.com, recipe 252167.
It's like a Caesar salad with kale.
I'm making it tonight. That looks fabulous. And you're right. Quinoa is great in anything. It's great in salads. Yeah. Yeah.
And it picks up the flavor of the dressing. Right.
And gives it protein, apples. Which is nice.
You add the apples. You add some dried cranberries. And everyone's happy.
I'm clicking the heart to save this recipe.
See?
Kevin Marks stayed up late in Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
If you wait a little. I was going to say, you'll hear the Hound of the Baskervilles howling on the moors.
North Yorkshire.
If you don't go to bed soon.
That's Dartmoor.
Dartmoor, of course. Oh, hello, Poodle.
Hello, Fluffy.
Oh, my.
Hello, Poodle.
This is Phoebe. She's been patiently waiting, but she needs to get fed soon.
Is this is Kofifi? Is that what you said?
Phoebe.
Kofifi and Anand?
Was terrible.
You named your poodle after the Secretary General of the United Nations? What? All right. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate your coming by. Go feed Fifi.
Phoebe.
Poodles should be named Fifi, I think. I'm just going to
rename
her.
I think it's a law.
Yeah. Jeff Jarvis, he is a professor of journalism at City University of New York. That's why he's all dressed up, because he's a professor. Also an author of many great volumes, including Gutenberg the Geek, Public Parts, What Would Google Do, and Geek Sparing Gifts. BuzzMachine.com is his blog. Thank you all.
I'm sending Stacey one of them.
Are you?
Yes. Well, I can actually buy it. And, you know,
No. I'll send it to you.
Is Public Parts?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a good book. That's a very good book about these very issues.
I was like, what about his other books, Leo?
I like What Would Google Do? Gutenberg. I love them all.
That's how we landed here, I think.
I think so. Yeah. That's
poor Leo's
exactly
been trying to say goodbye five times.
I don't want to say goodbye. I'm having too much fun.
I'll hang up first.
We do This Week in Google every... You can all hang up now because this is just all business. I want to do the business. It's business time. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 2030 UTC. If you tune in and you want to watch live, you can join us in the chat room too, irc.twit.tv. If you can't watch live, you can watch on demand. We certainly make everything available on our website, twit.tv/twig for this show. But you'll also find it in your favorite podcast program. So download a podcast program, subscribe to Twig, and don't miss an episode. There you go. I will not be here for the next couple of weeks. I think Jason Howell is filling in. Yeah. Off on vacation to the great Inca. Well, it turns out it's kind of disappointing. Hiram Bingham, who found it in 1911, thought it was the lost city of the Incas. Turned out it was just a rich Inca's summer home. But it is up there in the Andes. It's quite beautiful. 600-year-old ruins, Machu Picchu. And then I will be coming down from the mountaintop and going into the ocean and visiting the Galapagos Islands. And I will be back in 3 weeks from today. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.